All right, good morning. Today is March 1st, first day of a new month, and it is today's Land Use and Sustainability Committee meeting. I'm joined by my colleagues and Vice Chair Commissioner Laura Dominguez and colleague Commissioner David Richardson. Nick, do we have anybody on the phone or on Zoom?
Not yet, but I'll let you know.
Okay, great. Okay. Tom, some housekeeping items you want to announce?
Yeah, I want to announce that item number 7 pertaining to an LDR amendment relating to live-work units in mixed-use buildings in the CD2 district is being deferred to the April 19th Land Use Committee meeting. And Nick, did you want to make the announcement about number 8?
Yes, thank you, Tom. On item number 8, the sponsor has asked that the item be deferred so that he can work with the administration before it comes back.
Okay.
And that'll also be deferred to April 19th.
Okay. I'm not sure. I'm told Commissioner Fernandez is in the building, so hopefully he'll be joining us. So I'm going to wait a little bit to call his items up. So I'll just go in order on the action items. First up will be item number 2, to discuss the creation of a transfer of development rights program, a TDR. We talked about this last committee meeting. My intent is to talk about it some more today and probably at our next land use committee meeting, and then pending how we all feel about it, either pass it on to the full commission or not. Tom, I'm going to turn it over to you, if you don't mind, to sort of walk us through, unless colleagues, you already feel you're starting to get information and want to state some opinions or questions.
Okay.
Do you want to kind of just go over what
Sure. We've
already talked about?
Definitely. So we put together a memo that basically summarizes what TDRs are. And TDR stands for Transfer of Development Rights. And what it is it's a program that would allow for property owners in what are known as sending districts to move available FAR or intensity to another property that would be within what's known as a receiving district. And the City Commission in TDR programs will identify specific sending districts and specific receiving districts. So in a TDR program, it's not like anybody can just send FAR wherever they want. Specific sending districts are identified and specific receiving districts are identified. And those districts are identified for strategic reasons. Typically, a lot of times, a TDR program is created so that in those districts where it's very challenging to utilize available FAR, such as historic districts, it can be very beneficial for property owners to be able to sell those rights so that they can use those funds to retain and restore their existing historic building and do necessary upgrades. Similarly, receiving districts are typically areas of a city that are ripe for additional development and have the capacity in the room to add additional floor area. And so those are typically your receiving districts. One of the best things about a TDR program is that unlike an FAR overlay or a flat FAR increase, there is no net increase in intensity because it's the same amount of intensity in floor area. It's just being relocated to a different area of the city, and in a lot of instances, an area of the city that can better accommodate that intensity. Some of the areas that we've identified, at least just for discussion purposes, as potential sending sites for TDRs include the Flamingo Park Historic District, and as you're aware, that district consists of a lot of very smaller 2 to 3 story buildings where it's very challenging to max out the FAR and do significant additions. The Ocean Beach Historic District, the Museum Historic District, the Collins Waterfront Historic District, as well as the Normandy Island North Shore districts in North Beach. Some of the potential receiving areas, and some of these areas also coincide with item number 3, which deals with transit-oriented development, include the Fifth Street Corridor, the Alton Road Corridor, the West Avenue Corridor, and the 41st Street Corridor. Another potential area could also be the 17th Street Corridor. And these areas have been identified because of the number of parcels that are ripe for new development vacant parcels, parcels that don't have significant buildings on them, and also because all of these parcels are within transit corridors, and that's the type of corridor that we believe can accommodate more than just auto-related mobility. It could very easily accommodate transit mobility as well as micromobility. And so the next steps would be to reach consensus on where the potential sending area should be, where the receiving area should be, and then make a recommendation to the commission. The commission would then have to either approve a ballot question for the proposed increase in FAR, or perhaps refer a first reading ordinance to the planning board for transmittal that would more specifically identify the areas. The other thing that's important to point out is that there is typically a maximum amount of floor area that can be accumulated in a receiving district. So it's not like if Fifth Street was chosen as a receiving district, somebody could pile up an FAR of 10. There's typically a limit, so the voters would be approving a limit. You can have an FAR of up to this, which means once you reach that, you can't accumulate any more additional FAR.
That's a good point. Colleagues, questions or suggestions or feelings?
I've spoken to a few of the neighborhood associations on this, and I think that some more outreach is needed. Areas like West Avenue and Flamingo Park weren't 100% opposed to it, but they wanted to learn more and were concerned about the density.
Yeah. So, Tom, I notice on the receiving there's pretty much everything in South Beach except for the 41st Street corridor. What about any areas in North Beach? Do you think there are areas there that might be appropriate for this?
We haven't really studied North Beach. We didn't identify any initially because the town center, as you're aware, already went through a very significant increase in FAR. And I'm sure that we could study additional areas in North Beach. I think they would probably be more narrowly crafted, perhaps along Normandy Isle or perhaps Upper Collins. But we certainly could take a look at the North Beach area to see if there are any potential areas that could accommodate that.
Yeah, I think you should at least look at between 73rd and 75th, that commercial area that's two blocks or three blocks. And I would look at Normandy, especially on the west side, where there's some older buildings that might be available for removal and something else. So I would look at areas in North Beach. And then to the question Commissioner Dominguez raised about different communities, if we had a limit, would it be the same limit in every receiving, or could you have different limits in different receiving areas?
You can have different limits in different receiving areas. Some receiving areas may be able to accommodate higher FAR. Some may not be able to accommodate higher FAR. So you could definitely have different limits in different receiving districts.
Yeah. And what about can a sending area, could an owner send to two different places?
Yes.
Okay.
In sending areas, we also will typically require that a property retain a minimum amount of FAR just in case they need to do some type of addition, small addition in the future. And certainly if a property in a sending district is already over their maximum FAR, they would not be eligible to send intensity.
Yeah. And if we were to send, so if we were to look at the limits that we want to have, is that something you would make a recommendation, or we'd send that to the planning board first and let them look at it, or what would you recommend to us?
That's something that we could take a look at that and come back with some recommendations on what the limits would be in those areas, and then the commission could either refer that or refer it as more of an open question and ask the planning board to weigh in on how they feel about the limits.
Yeah. So, Chair, I would be interested in having staff come back and give us some preliminary look at a couple of areas in North Beach and also give us some idea of what they're thinking about in terms of limits. And then I guess we'd have to send this back to the commission, and then because it's not a dual referral.
Correct.
and then send it to the planning board and get them to look at it and make a recommendation. And then, yeah, I think we should send it to the planning board and have them look at it as well.
Yeah. More, anything? Is your folks, are there folks who want to talk about this? Tim, you want to? Come on up.
On behalf of West Ave Neighborhood Association, thank you for your time. And again, we do support smart, responsible growth, absolutely. We all want to be there. And actually, we're working with the Chavot development right now, for example, on West Ave, and that's an example of a good neighborhood partnership of Class A office buildings that we want to bring that mixed use. So again, and we've also invited Tom to come to our April meeting to talk a little bit more about this for more resident engagement, because we really do want to learn more about the best options. But we are a little conservative because we are a neighborhood. We want to kind of keep the balance of our neighborhood. So I appreciate thinking out of the box and where we need to go as a community with this. But I would ask, and again, I appreciate the referral to planning board. So the more that we can vet this process, I think we can all together come up with the best possible solution to keep the balance of the communities and the opportunity for smart development. Conservative smart development, though. Thank you.
So, colleagues, let me sort of riff here a bit. thanks, Tim, for your comments. So, look, I'm sponsoring this for a host of reasons. You know, I would say, you know, if you had to label something like a TDR as well as the next item, transit-oriented development, as well as potentially FAR for workforce housing, first and foremost, it's one of two things: historic preservation, particularly with respect to TDR, trying to create some tools to further create some economic value for historic preservation. And then secondly, it's to create workforce housing, right? It's not to encourage more development or just more FAR. It's to give the city more tools than we currently possess to hit two policy objectives that we've all said we have, which is to create more workforce housing and to encourage the preservation of our historic buildings. We lack some tools that other municipalities have, including TDRs and flexibility with FAR. So that's why bringing these for our consideration, and ultimately voters will vote for this. And they'll decide how seriously they want to take historic preservation, how seriously they want to take workforce housing. Because all of this will be tailored towards those objectives. I'm sitting here just thinking it's March 1st, and the timeline to get something on the ballot and before voters in November is pretty tight. So I worry, you know, I retire come November, so we don't have a lot of time. You know, I don't want to spin our wheels. I don't want to spin my wheels. If someone who will be here beyond November isn't willing to co-sponsor this and take this on, this is going to die in the vines, because what's going to happen is I will end up doing a lot of work on this, and then one of us, and I think we can guess who, will firebomb this at the 11th hour, saying that this is, you know, something that it's not. And so staff will spend a lot of time. We'll probably have to engage some consultants. We'll do a lot of community outreach. And then come October, this will become an election issue, people running for office, and, you know, the person or persons who tend to firebomb at the last minute will misinform the public and tank all the work that we do here. So if this is going to move forward, I'm going to need some co-sponsors on this. So if your heart's not in this, let me and staff know early so we don't spin wheels anymore. I do think the right approach is what we've talked about. We have to start doing some community outreach now, get hopefully support from the community so that the firebombing can't take place. If we think about this in terms of, you know, donor districts and recipient districts, and the donor districts are, in fact, our historic districts, and we're creating economic value for them to transfer unused FAR, that money will be tied to reinvestment in their properties to make them resilient for another 100 years and or beautifying their neighborhood. I think that's a winning strategy. And if the recipient projects would have to use them for things like workforce housing. I think that's also a winning idea. That's what this is about. I just want to keep beating that drum, because we all know there will be folks that will try to use this for their own purposes, to scare the public, mislead the public, for their own purposes, and in fact they're going to harm the public. They don't come up with solutions. They're always against things. They're never for things. They never do the work that we're doing here in committee, coming up with ideas. So I just want to put that out in the ether, because that's coming. So, you know, I need, you know, staff needs all of our help. If we really think this is a good idea, we're all going to have to get behind this.
So I will, I like that. I guess I didn't understand that immediately, but if it's from, if the money, if the funds have to go in from the sending to restoration of the property and then workforce housing or affordable housing, I think that's a terrific idea. And if it's limited to that, I'm certainly willing to co-sponsor it as well. And I'm just curious if, given the timeline, if we should just go ahead and send this back to the commission, because if there's not going to be support, it's probably better that we know that.
Yeah.
Now
that's where I was going with this, is I think the right steps would be to have lots of community outreach and you know, keep it here. But I'd like to get the temperature of the full commission, particularly one or two, to know if they're going to firebomb, because we got to buy into this. Because if this is not going to fly, I want to know what their solution is for workforce housing, because I had never heard an actual plan for workforce housing from any of the people who like to firebomb good ideas. So, you know, I think the public has the right to know that the people they elected talk about workforce housing but actually don't back it up.
So if it's the will of the committee, I will move it back to the commission and then also ask Tom to look at the sending and the receiving, and also more specifically what the sending area owners must do with the funds. And also the receiving, you know, if it's going to be workforce housing and affordable housing, and if there's something else that you think is appropriate. I see in your notes potentially resiliency enhancements, so things that are very limited like that. So I'll move that.
And then I just have a question. The deadline to get language for the ballot, is that July or
yes, so the last regular commission meeting at which ballot questions could be approved is July 26th. So we would need transmittal by the planning board no later than June 27th.
And within that time, we would need to get the community outreach and all of that stuff. So
I'll say this: if we are comfortable with something like this, and we craft the ballot language and get it out, we actually have all the way till November for the community outreach. You know, so we do have that time. We should start now, obviously, but if we come to a resolution where we think, okay, we are comfortable with crafting ballot language with certain parameters to put in front of voters, that's the clock I'm most worried about, because that's coming up, maybe 4 or 5 months at most. But then we would have, you know, from now until really November to meet with voters and, you know, either build support or not for something like this. But what my big concern, because it's real, is that we do all this work. And then, you know, one or two of us will come in October and start freaking out the public with lies. And then we're just wasting our time. That's what I want to avoid. Start getting the buy-in. But, Tom, I'd like, if possible, for you and the team, to the best of your ability with such tight timelines, to be prepared for likely questions from us so that we don't have to keep coming back. And I think some of those things to consider are what Commissioner Richardson was talking about, which is uses of funds, you know, and we can all kind of weigh in on that. But I think you're hearing about workforce housing, historic preservation, keeping the money in a donor district, things like sunsetting. You know, do you have 5 years, 10 years, 7 years to put this to work? You mentioned cap on FAR for additional protections. Question I have is, do we have ballpark inventory on unused FAR in the donor districts?
We can put together some numbers that won't quite be 100%, but they'll give us a good ballpark idea. Yeah, yeah. It'll be a good ballpark.
And then the other thing would be, you know, getting granular, not for the next meeting, but eventually, you know, let's say you have a building and they've got like a fraction of FAR unused. You know, there should be a minimum that they should be able to contribute. Otherwise, it might be tough to administer this, because administering the FAR program, the TDR, might become very cumbersome if we don't have some easy-to-apply rules.
Yeah, in these programs, typically, the only way somebody is eligible is if they have available FAR. So if somebody is legal nonconforming, unfortunately, they're not eligible. But if they do have FAR, they would be eligible. Now, some programs will mandate that all properties must retain a certain amount of FAR. So let's say the maximum FAR in RM1 is 1.25 and somebody's got 1.24. You know, the question becomes, should they be able to transfer out that remaining 0.1, or should properties be required to maintain a certain minimal amount of floor area in case they need to do something like add a utility room or something like that? And we can certainly come up with some recommendations on that. But the big thing that will need voter approval is the receiving districts, because they will be increasing FAR. And if the voters are comfortable with that and comfortable with the general parameters for sending districts, then a lot of the details, the granular details of the sending district requirements, can certainly be worked out as part of the enabling legislation.
Yeah, the recipient district, in order for them to get that FAR, you know, my strong preference and support would only be, you only can get it if it's going to be used for workforce housing as defined by, you know, the commission. You know, otherwise, you can't get it. You know, so that would be the guarantee the public has, is that, okay, you know, we're creating a mechanism for transferring FAR, but for the sole purpose of creating more workforce housing. So because we are going to be creating more density in certain recipient neighborhoods, but we're going to be saying that density is for workforce housing, not luxury condos.
So the draft that we'll come back with, and what we'll do is we'll put this on as an R9 discussion item on March 27th, but the draft information that we'll come back with would include a requirement that receiving districts must utilize this additional FAR for workforce and affordable housing.
And then start thinking in your mind, are we going to need to engage some consultants to help us craft this? And then, you know, let's tee that
up. Our consultants that we used for the resiliency code, as you recall, we were able to budget funds for them to do follow-up work on four areas. This is one of those areas. And so they certainly would be available to assist us with the drafting of the legislation.
Okay. Any comments?
I would say, Tom, I'm in agreement with the chair about workforce housing, affordable housing, and then in your memo you have resiliency enhancements. So if you want to include that, I would be more specific and tell us exactly, because I don't want this to get too broad and then people use words to confuse people about what we're trying to do. This is not about transferring FAR for luxury condos.
Mr. Chairman, we have one caller on Zoom, Jesus or Jesus.
Okay, good morning, Jesus, is that his name? Okay, good morning, Jesus.
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you so much. I wanted just to ask the question of, Where is the data that is coming for some of the arguments that are being presented? Like, for instance, the need for affordable housing in those specific regions, or the need for the receiving zoning to have increased commercial density. If it seems to me that if we're going to make an effort to move this to the commission and consultants will be engaged, there should be some available data already at the moment for even that effort to be worthwhile, the investment.
Are you saying where's the data for the need for workforce housing? Are you breaking
in,
up there?
In the receiving zones, yes. In the receiving zones. So if we are planning on, say, the benefits are that we're going to have resilient buildings and more increased affordable housing or funding available for certain to increase density of the receiving areas, what is the need that is driving that effort?
Okay, well, I think that'll be part of the presentation at the commission meeting.
Okay, but like it sounds that even to just get that effort done, we should have some basis because the proposal is being made. So at least there should be a need for that proposal to come, right? Like, otherwise, it seems to me that probably even the effort of taking it to the commission and hiring consultants may be already too much if there is no specific evidence that this is needed.
I think that there's a demonstrable need for more workforce housing in the city of Miami Beach. I think that's a foregone conclusion. So I think that will be unanimous at the commission that we need more workforce housing in the city of Miami Beach. Now, how we achieve that may be, we may have different ideas, but I don't think there'll be anyone of the seven elected members that believe that we don't need more workforce housing.
Not to make the point too much longer, if that information could be made available probably as part of the next memorandums that are written in this topic, that would be very useful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I see two more hands. Amy Litos?
Pardon me?
I see two more hands on Zoom. Amy Litos?
Okay, good morning, Amy.
Thank you. I think the previous caller was trying to make the point that this particular area of the city has been targeted in a sense. There are several items on recent agendas for upzoning, for increasing density, VAR, creating rapid transit routes. And quite frankly, this area is not able to handle all of that. Mr. Mooney stated that nothing in North Beach has been studied. I would ask that you do that first. There are other parts of our city which need workforce housing, which need better transit equally. And it seems that too much of this is being concentrated in the southern part of the city. And I ask that you reconsider this proposal and look at other parts of the city first. Thank you.
Not sure if you saw the memo. Amy, are you still on? Did you see the memo? Because not sure what you're referring to with the southern part of the city. Tom, you identified several places that could be recipient.
Yes, we had – this was – and again, it's important to point out that these were just initial receiving districts that were identified based upon a number of factors, but they include Fifth Street, Alton Road, 41st Street, I did mention 17th Street, and we can certainly look at the areas of North Beach that we've discussed.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. For sure, bring back areas of North Beach, because, I mean, everything should be considered. Okay.
And our last caller is Joseph Magazine.
Okay. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning, all. Thank you for everything, and thank you for the creative outside-the-box efforts. Without opining on my opinion for the overall program, because I do want to approach it with an open mind, I will just say you will find no bigger advocate in the city for helping housing affordability and bringing residential housing to our city. I do think, though, that by limiting this to textbook definition, workforce and affordable housing really boxes us in, one, in the type of development you're able to create, because really, it's going to be constructed by very strict AMI limits that is just going to bring additional red tape. to me how you ensure that it isn't these ultra-luxury $40 million boxes in the sky is by their location. And if these are the areas, kind of infill areas on Alton Road, I think that while they wouldn't command your textbook workforce and affordable housing AMI affordability limits, it would be more attainable just given that it's an infill, non-prime, non-luxury location. So I do think we should at least give some consideration to expanding that definition if this program does move forward. The people that not only did I see pressured in the city from an affordability standpoint aren't just your people that are fitting into those textbook AMI definitions, but also your white-collar workers as well. And if we're expanding our diversifying our economy with office workers, we also need a place to accommodate them as well, because the last thing I'd want to see is our office expansion efforts be futile because we don't have housing for these professionals to live in. So again, thank you for your attention, and look forward to at least exploring this idea.
Anyone else?
There's no one else.
Okay, I think Eric, did you want to say something?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just wanted to make one clarification. There seemed to be some confusion with at least one of the callers about the resiliency components. Those were part of the sending districts, not part of the receiving districts. So I think we were clear about the receiving districts benefiting by the transfer of the FAR for use on workforce or affordable housing. There's a secondary benefit that we touched on a little earlier, which is these historic districts that would be the sending districts would benefit from investment into those historic buildings for purposes of preservation and resiliency. Just wanted to clarify that.
Got it. Okay. Let's roll into item number three, which is related.
So one other thing, Tom, maybe when you bring it back, you can look at this idea that Mr. Magazine was talking about and how we define that. I think we have to be careful, because if it starts getting too confusing, then somebody's going to use that to confuse the public. But
in terms of the AMI?
Yeah, and maybe, I don't know, just give us some ideas. Maybe it's a project that, you know, is 70% of workforce housing and has something. I don't know what it is, but just I would just look at that issue.
Okay. And then just to conclude this, Commissioner Richardson, you made the motion, and Mr. Chair, did you second? Okay. And then Commissioner Richardson, just to confirm, you wanted to add yourself as a co-sponsor?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's roll over into item number three, which is related. Discuss the identification and development of transit-oriented development zones. So we discussed this at the last committee meeting. Tom, do you want to tee us up on this?
Sure. One of the things that was also identified as part of the drafting of the resiliency code was the potential to identify areas in the city that could accommodate transit-oriented development. And transit-oriented development is a very, very broad concept, and it can include from smaller, more neighborhood-oriented, transit-oriented projects to the much larger full block. You've probably seen a lot of these along US 1 at the Coconut Grove Metro Station, the Douglas Road Metro Station. Certainly the Dadeland Metro Stations have a lot of transit-oriented development. And it typically will include a mix of uses that can be accommodated by multi-modes of transportation. And so it's not just vehicles that can allow you to access these developments, but they typically are served by a dedicated transit line. They don't always have to be a rail line. It could be dedicated bus lines, trolley lines, and they will also typically have a micro-mobility component. Sometimes they'll include park-and-ride components where people can come in, and it's an interceptor garage where people could work there and then potentially use other modes of transportation to get around the city if they're going to lunch, if they're going somewhere after work, or people could live there and be able to use that as a hub for transit to a job outside the area. So a lot of transit-oriented development projects do include more FAR because that increase in intensity and in density is meant to foster uses that don't rely solely on the automobile. And so, but they can also include projects that don't necessarily have an increase in FAR, but again, with more emphasis on multiple modes of transportation and not solely relying on the private vehicle. We've identified some areas in the city that we think would be ideal candidates for transit-oriented development, which include, obviously, the Fifth Street Corridor between Alton Road and Ocean Drive, the Alton Road Corridor, potentially the West Avenue Corridor, and then also we've identified the 17th Street Corridor from west to Washington Avenue as also being a potential candidate. In Mid-Beach and North Beach, you do also have some areas that could potentially be ripe for transit-oriented development, including 41st Street, and certainly a lot of Normandy Drive and the Town Center area, we think, will hopefully develop into more multimodal modes of transit that could also be considered for TODs.
Yeah, the last two would have been my my comments for this, which is 41st Street and those areas of North Beach, I think, are ideally suited for transit oriented development. They're dense and potentially will become denser. With full time residents that work for a living, as opposed to retirees who use luxury condominiums as third and fourth homes. I think we need to find suitable ways for folks to get around our city and off out of our city to go to work without having to have a car. So to the extent that we can design things, plan things so that folks don't need to have a car or two cars for a family, I think that would be wise. So, colleagues, yep.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I worry about the density. We're a small island, and every single time there's an idea, it always relates to FAR and adding more density to areas that are pretty dense already. But we do need to do something for mobility and traffic and transit. So willing to learn more about this.
Yeah. Look, I'm all for ideas. This is why I'm coming up with ideas. No pride of ownership. If folks have better ideas, then I'm all ears and I'll fully support. My frustration is when people just critique but don't come up with solutions. So still waiting for the fire bombers to come up with actual ideas on helping really improve traffic and not just talking about traffic light synchronization, which is like rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. We need actual ideas that move traffic or eliminate traffic and not just get one car through an intersection 30 seconds faster than otherwise would be the case. We have to figure out ways of improving our resident quality of life, decreasing the cost of home ownership, which includes having to own a car. So that's what these are trying to do. So if these are not good ideas, I'd love to hear better ones.
So I would, I think this is something that we should certainly look at. I do worry that given that we are talking about the previous item, right, that if we were to, because this may require a referendum as well, and then it may be too much too fast, and that's my only concern in that someone is going to grab on this and say, not only is it one item, it's two items, and as you said, firebomb it. So
yeah,
that's my only concern.
Yeah, I mean, this is down the road, because this relies on mass transit, which we have some effect on, like with our city trolleys, but to the extent that these are going to require county bus assistance and or a Bay Link and or, some other mass transit solution, the state, the county, possibly the federal government, will need to provide those services. But from a city planning perspective, we can at least start identifying certain zones where a mass transit solution can be brought in, so that we're ready for those solutions when and if they come. You know, clearly we're not going to make our single-family neighborhoods transit-oriented zones, but certainly, you know, high-density multifamily communities where parking is very challenging would be an ideal area for transit-oriented development. Do we have any callers, Nick?
No, we don't.
All right. Tom, I think, you know, my personal feeling is...
May I speak real quick?
Oh, I'm sorry, Tim. I have my head down.
Good afternoon again. Tim Carr, West Ave Neighborhood Association. Again, I really appreciate the discussion here because as a city, we need to continue to move forward and really identify the latest technologies. And I hear you loud and clear. You know, I don't like people when they just complain and don't offer solutions. Many of us have spent a lot of our time recently with the recent Baylink proposal to come up with smart, efficient transportation options for this city. So, again, with a lot of time and a lot of money of our own, we've created a website called RethinkTheBaylink.com, and we continue to update it weekly with really kind of recommendations to help this city move forward with really the best possible efficient transportation options that everybody from North, Mid, and South Beach can take advantage of. The other thing to keep in mind is we already have, for many of us who are lucky enough to live on the island, we already walk and bike majority of everywhere we have. I have a car right now, but because I live here, it is more efficient for me to walk and bike most of the places I go. So we've already achieved that, so please keep that in mind. Also, for the West Ave Neighborhood Association, West Ave in particular is a residential neighborhood, so we would like to keep that in perspective. The other thing that we know that's coming is the bus rapid transit. So that's going to be coming down MacArthur, and it's going to be coming in Julia Tuttle. So let's see how that does, because that's a very inexpensive, efficient fix for people who need more bus rapid transit to get in and out of the city. But many of us already use the current bus system to get over to the Arts Center so we don't have to park or anything, and it works very well. So let's keep those things in perspective as well in this process. So I continue to appreciate the dialogue. And again, go to that website. And I think you'll be impressed in what we put together on our own initiative to come up with solutions for the city. Thank you.
Yeah, to your point, Tim, you know, in terms of, you know, improving our residents' quality of life, you know, through just sheer enjoyment of the outdoors and everything the city has to offer and reducing traffic. I mean, you know, there's a lot of the little things that we've done, and I know you've been a big part of, you know, trying to finally open our Baywalk where you live. Obviously, you know, I think we're all very proud of the continuation of our beach walk, you know, all the way from South Beach to 87th, the development of parks, including in your neighborhood, smart planning in terms of mixed use for retail as well as residential and potentially now office, so that we can do exactly what you just said, walk to work, walk to a park, you know, walk and enjoy our outdoors. I mean, all that increases our residents' quality of life, and that's our job, to try to plan for those things, and you do that through intelligent zoning and planning. You know, and these are all the little things that, you know, we do to try to improve our residents' quality of life, to do all the things that you mentioned, which is just walk or bike to work, walk or bike to the dry cleaner, grocery store, park, whatever. And, you know, that's what we're up here trying to do with all of these items. So thank you. Yeah, Tom, my comment would be, you know, let's look at obviously 41st Street and then those areas of North Beach that you mentioned.
Mr. Chairman, we now have one caller on Zoom if you'd like.
Sure, of course.
Mark Needle.
Morning, Mark.
Good morning. So I just wanted to respond with an idea, an actual thing that you all could do now that Flamingo Park in the past has made a point about, and that is that there in some areas, including Alton Road, but on transit corridors, I think maybe the 41st was another one. There are bonus FARs that still were retained by the city, and they really are just for residential, which is not really achieving the goals of attracting people who don't want cars to live on transit corridors. So right now, you could initiate legislation to change the bonus FARs that exist in the city that are on potential transit corridors to be for folks who do not need cars for essentially workforce housing. That would be a really robust and interesting discussion. It's within your power. It doesn't increase density, even in the zones that we're talking about. So it's a concrete step that you all could take if you really wanted to improve workforce, non-transit, non-auto dependent housing along at least Alton Road and I believe one or two other places in the city.
Okay, thanks. Mark, Tom, I see your head nodding. Did you want to chime in?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that that is something that could potentially be done legislatively. I think what Mr. Nito is referring to is the 0.5 bonus that's available in the CD2 district for residential or hotel, and the commission could certainly limit that to just residential. I don't believe that that would run afoul of the charter because it's already permitted. The big question is whether or not the commission would want to limit that bonus to those units that don't need a vehicle. There have been cities that have done that. Minneapolis did that in some areas of their city where they literally prohibited vehicles within certain zones. And so if you wanted to live in that area, you had to basically park your car remotely or rely on transit.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in exploring that further. I mean, I've been advocating for that kind of on an ad hoc basis as, you know, projects come up that, you know, are looking for, relief from our parking requirements for that very purpose is to try to encourage development that doesn't have parking so that people self-select into projects where they're going to live and, you know, almost have to work on Miami Beach because they're not going to have a car, which I think helps address traffic as well, right? So if you don't own a car, then you're either going to rely on mass transit or you're going to, you know, walk to work or bike to work. That gets you out of a car. So I'm very supportive of that idea. I don't know, colleagues, you want to jump on that or sponsor that? Anybody want to sponsor that? Because what happens is I sponsor these things and then the flamethrowers come in and jump all over me, and I got to take it by myself.
I'll tell you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
When I travel around the world, I see areas to have zero emission zones. The thing is, when I've asked our city attorneys about it, I believe that we're preempted by the state in creating these zero emission zones, that we can't limit vehicles that have emissions versus those that don't have emissions or you know, put those type of restrictions in place. So we're limited as to how we can limit vehicles themselves in certain areas. Even I think, removing cars altogether requires county approval for that. Correct me if I'm wrong, Nick.
I think so. We are preempted from imposing tolling or from restricting access to certain types of cars, but we can. We can do, and I think it is subject to county approval, pedestrianizations of certain streets on a more limited basis.
I'm just concerned with traffic right now, yeah. Closing more roads. I think I'll have people picketing outside my house.
Okay. Well, good timing, Commissioner Fernandez. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. You have a number of items on the agenda. Are there any that you'd like to here first.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Number three, did you want to keep that at committee?
Yeah, sorry. Keep it here and then add those other zones.
Okay. Do you want to continue it maybe to the May meeting?
Yeah, we don't have to keep it on the agenda. I mean, I think we've discussed it to death. There's no action that I see at the moment coming.
Okay.
I think the ones that need to be workshopped are items number two, and we haven't discussed item five yet. Those, I think, will need action. I don't know that number three needs it yet. Correct me if I'm wrong. The topic of transit-oriented development zones, that becomes a real issue if items two and five pass.
Yeah, potentially. And then also the other thing that would inform transit-oriented development in Miami Beach is how the different forms of regional connectivity begin to evolve. And so perhaps we continue this to the June Land Use Committee and then just for an update.
Yeah. Look, I think you have identified the appropriate zones, right? So it's not like we're not going to be in harmony with the county's plans, right? We're not going to say, oh, we're going to go target the very upper areas of North Beach for transit-oriented zones because that would be incompatible with the county's already planning. And it's also we don't have any development up there to begin with. So I think we should target where we already have density, where we already have folks that are using bus or trolleys to get around, and then try to, plan more intelligently to concentrate resources in those areas. But yeah, I think continue it to the June meeting.
Okay.
Enough time, and then let's see where we go with item number two and item number five. Commissioner Fernandez, did you want to bring any item up first?
Sure. If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, there was item number one regarding commercial regulations for North Beach to address the proliferation of nuisance uses. And if this is an item that we began discussing at the last Land Use Committee meeting, as you may recall, we discussed classifying as a prohibited use in the areas north of 63rd Street, regardless of the zoning district, certain uses such as the tobacco and the vape dealers, the occult science establishments, tattoo studios, vitamin shops, pawn shops, and the souvenir and T-shirt stores, which oftentimes take over block after block of certain areas. We asked staff to go back and look at setting a cap on packaged liquor stores, on check cashing stores, and convenience stores. And I'd like to, if you allow me, Mr. Chair, recognize our planning director to update us on the progress they've made on that.
Sure. Commissioner Fernandez is correct. At the last Land Use Committee meeting, there was general consensus on the uses that we had identified to be prohibited uses, with the exception of those three uses, which were package stores, convenience stores, and check cashing stores. We did some research regarding the number of existing establishments, and those are included as a list, as an attachment to the Land Use Committee memo. And basically, there are two existing check cashing stores in the North Beach area, and so we've suggested that there be a cap of up to four check cashing stores north of 63rd Street. Similarly, there's a limited number of existing packaged liquor stores. There's about six packaged liquor stores. So we've recommended that there be a cap of six packaged liquor stores. That would allow existing packaged stores that want to relocate or move to do so, provided that they meet the minimum distance separation requirements that are already in place in Chapter 6 of the Code. The one use that is a little tricky is the convenience stores. Currently, there's approximately 35 convenience stores from what we estimate. The list here includes about 44, but we think through scrubbing it, it's probably going to be more like about 30 to 35 stores that actually meet the definition of convenience stores. So one of the things we suggested was perhaps establishing a cap of 15, which would basically create a lot of legal nonconforming convenience stores, but through attrition, you would see a reduction. Another option might be to place a cap of up to 30 or 35, which, like the liquor stores, would allow the existing ones potentially to relocate if they went out of business. So I think we just need some either direction or confirmation regarding the draft cap numbers that we've come up with. And with that, I think it will be ready for us to bring this to the planning board. This was a door referral, so we can take it directly to the planning board.
And just as a follow-up, so, Mr. Planning Director, you're recommending a cap of no more than six packaged liquor stores. In other parts of the code, we have a minimum distance requirement of 1,500 feet between these packaged liquor stores. Is your recommendation to maintain that, or are we changing that in any way? What's your recommendation?
We would maintain the distance separation. So if somebody had a packaged liquor store and they wanted to relocate, they would have to meet the minimum distance separation requirement. That would prevent the close aggregation of those uses within a confined area.
And the last issue that we touched upon at the last meeting, land use meeting, was the massage therapy establishments, and we weren't sure how we would handle that in this proposal, and my idea would be to bifurcate that from this and come forward with a separate item, because I would like to see how we don't prohibit the massage therapy establishments altogether, but perhaps incorporate them in larger establishments, if it's part of a hotel, if it's part of a school, or if it's part of a medical facility. But other than that, I want to thank you, Mr. Planning Director. You know, our intent is to limit the proliferation of establishments that can negatively affect the surrounding areas in North Beach, because we do want to revitalize the area and encourage, you know, unique retail experiences there. And I think this helps us achieve that. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to present my item.
Wonderful. Colleagues?
So what is your wish on the massages, to bifurcate that, keep that in committee, and you're hoping to move the rest back to the commission?
I was going to work on perhaps on some language with the planning director, and maybe do a new referral, a separate referral on that, or we can keep that part in committee and just move the rest of the item. Whatever is the will of the body, either is fine with me.
Was the massage within the original?
I think that for North Beach, if you wanted to limit the massage therapy regulations to North Beach, we could probably do it as part of this discussion. I think if you wanted it to be citywide, I would suggest sending that back to the commission as a separate referral.
And what was were you talking about North Beach here, right?
Yes.
This is related to North Beach.
North Beach. I'm happy to keep that part here, and that way we don't have to go through the process of, I mean, the last thing we need to do is more paperwork, another referral, placing more items on the agenda. So if it's the will of this body, I'm happy to keep that part of it here.
But I think that may be ready, because I think, Tom, I think you know how we could handle that, right? As if it's a massage as it relates to a medical facility or a hotel or something else.
I think on that one, we would probably want to come back to you with some draft legislation and also work with legal on it to make sure, because some of the things, as Commissioner Fernandez pointed out, we were looking at is allowing these as part of larger spas, part of hotels, part of a school, for instance, like Educating Hands, part of a medical clinic, but finding a way to legally discern those from, you know, a standalone use that might not be as reputable. And so I think coming up with some specific language and analysis, I think as a separate item would make more sense.
And when do you think you could have that, in May?
Yeah, I think we could bring you back something in May.
So I'll move your item back to the commission, if that's what you want to do, and bifurcate that other item and bring that back here in May.
This was a dual referral, so your recommendation would be to the planning board.
Okay. I'm okay with that.
And for the convenience stores, we had recommended a cap of 15. Is that something that you're generally okay with, or did you want to modify that for the convenience stores?
I think, didn't you say right now you think there could be as many as 40?
Exactly. Yeah, between 35 and 40, potentially.
I'm not sure 15 is the right number, but maybe we should ask the planning board for their advice on that.
Okay, we can leave that as an open number, get their input, and then at first reading.
Because what would happen if one closes, then
a lot of them could close,
and then, right? So, and what we're finding, especially in the city, is a lot of things fall under the definition of convenience store, some things yes. that we might not even think would fall under the definition just because we've defined it. So, I'm not sure about that. I don't think I think the 15 is too low.
Okay.
That's a very good point.
Okay, any callers?
There are no callers.
So one thing I would like is, as this moves to the planning board and to the city commission, if we could somehow officially reach out to the area, to the whatever neighborhood association is there, or to the property owners in the area as well, just so that everyone is aware that this is going through the legislative process.
Okay.
Thank you, colleagues.
So Commissioner Richardson moved it. I'll second it. So
the motion would be to move the ordinance to the planning board, but to continue to study the cap on convenience stores, to do some public outreach prior to planning board, and then number three would be to bifurcate the massage therapy definition and locations and bring that back as a separate item at the May Land Use Committee.
Right. Great. Okay. Let's roll into item number four, Commissioner Fernandez. This is your item.
Yes.
It's a proposed overlay for the north side of Belle Isle, including Century Lane and Ferry Lane, to preserve the low-scale residential character of the neighborhood.
So, Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is continue this item until next month. I'm meeting with the homeowners of the area and the different parties involved because I want to make sure that what we bring forward is fair. And in general, just to give you an idea, because I would value the feedback of this committee since we are in the sunshine, what I'm looking at is regulations regarding new construction for single-family developments and to make sure that the regulations for a single-family home, for it to remain unchanged. I don't think it's fair for anyone who bought a home to now tell them, you know, you were planning 5-10 years down the road to build what you legally could, but now we're going to change you. So I would like to keep that unchanged. However, any non-single-family home development, and there's many that are allowed, there are religious institutions, there are apartments, there are duplex, there are multifamily, and all of these attract more traffic, those will have development restrictions in place, possibly a reduction in building height and habitable floors, you know, restricting rooftops, possible reduction in other things. I want to make sure that the parking design is in such a way that it's all internalized to the property. And the goal of any non-single-family development is to retain the single-family character of the street. So that's kind of what I'm looking at. I'm looking at some other things, you know, possibly looking at a construction schedule to minimize the impact on the residents of the street, you know, requiring for all construction to maintain a traffic and parking plan and making sure that it's properly enforced, you know, and some restrictions on the unification of lots. That's what I'm working on with the neighbors. I don't have draft language to this effect yet that I feel comfortable bringing to you, but since this is what I'm more or less working on, I just want to get your feedback as to what we as a body would feel comfortable with to retain the single-family character of this area of the city.
Okay. Laura, do you have any comments?
No, I'm supportive of what Commissioner Fernandez is working on. Both of those streets are tiny, without sidewalks, and what's been happening has been very disruptive for people coming in and out of their homes, and so this is a step in the right direction. And I think that your overlay is specific to Century and Ferry, single-family homes, because it really shouldn't apply to the standard, which has its own regulations.
So I think on the north side of Bell, I think the height right now is at 50, right?
Correct.
And we just had a new development that's not open yet. I think it's going to be a rental property right on the east side, and they're at 50.
Correct.
And, you know, as you said, Commissioner Fernandez, you know, people bought these homes thinking they could do something with it. I would not want them to take up the entire footprint because of the sustainability. We need water drainage and so forth. So I'm not going to be, you know, I'm very supportive of people retaining their property rights. And so I don't, whether you call it a taking or something else, I'm not going to be supportive of reducing that 50 feet. People made investments there. I don't know exactly what the plans are for the standard. I think they want to increase up to the 50 that they have. So we have a new development that got their 50, and so I'm not going to be supportive of reducing the height in that area for single family or for the hotel that's there, because I just don't think it's fair to the people that made the investment. If there are other things that you want to try to do that I can be supportive of, I'd love to be able to do that.
Just as a follow-up, so Century Lane, I see Century Lane and Ferry Lane, very unique. Those are very residential streets. What I'm concerned about is traffic. Traffic there, you know, small activity could limit the flow of traffic on Century and Ferry Lane. Even parking, just excess vehicles parking on the street could make it difficult for an emergency vehicle to make it to a property. As it relates to Century and Ferry Lane, would you feel comfortable in limiting the permitted uses to only single-family homes? And I need to get some guidance from the city attorney on that as well.
The commission has the legislative authority to amend the list of permitted uses in this district, as you do with any other. But I think that this is an RM1 district, and there are uses other than single-family homes,
right,
which are permitted. I think prohibiting uses other than single-family homes could give rise to claims by property owners under the Harris Act or otherwise.
I see. And the only reason why I bring that up is because one thing is a single-family home. You usually have limited traffic. Even so many people who are moving to our area from other parts, you know, they're buying single-family homes. Instead of having two or three cars as they used to, now they probably only have one car. But that, now if all of a sudden you have an apartment or a duplex or some other type of multifamily, you have multiple, it's not just one unit, it's multiple units, and that multiplies the amount of traffic you're bringing in there, the amount of parking needs, the amount of you know, if you have someone that comes once a week to clean your apartment, now, you know, you have that times four occupying space, or if you have a nanny, you know, you multiply that by four, or if you're having a New Year's Eve party, you know, you multiply that by four if you have a four-unit building. So that's my concern once we start going into the non-single-family uses that have typically defined this area.
And Commissioner, that may be you may want to look at incentives for single-family homes. If you're looking to discourage other types of uses, there may be other ways to get there.
Yeah, so I'm certainly open to hearing about some of these limitations, because I do think it's primarily a residential area, and I don't think it was really designed for some of these other things that are going on. So I'm certainly open on that. You know, what I'm particularly concerned about is, you know, the new development got their 50 feet, and then all of a sudden people are like, they don't think other people should get their 50 feet, and I just don't think that's fair to the people that made the investments. And so, but I hear what you're saying on the uses. I think there's a couple of properties there that are now becoming something other than what we would have originally thought they might be. So I'm certainly open to hearing more on that.
I do want to mention something. When people made their property purchases, they weren't buying into it thinking they can build 5- and 6-story family homes. It was a loophole that came up just a couple years ago. So that's what started the frenzy of the 5- and 6 story family homes. And the congestion that's happening on Century Lane, the Vistas only have one way in and one way out. And the construction is not permitting people to get in and out of their homes.
The construction from homes that are being
raised? Homes on Century Lane.
Okay. So I'm a little confused about the height thing. So was the 50 feet always there, or is that something new?
My understanding, it was a loophole that was discovered just a couple years ago. Tom can probably elaborate a little further.
The height limit has been in place since 1999 of 50 feet. Before 1999, the north side of Belle Isle, including Century and Ferry Lane, were actually zoned RM2, and I think the height limit may have been 100 feet. But in the downzoning, it was downzoned to RM1 with a height limit of 50, and that's been the height limit since then. We haven't seen construction replacing those small homes until recently, and that's where, when those were replaced, people decided that, well, even though they're limited to 1.25 FAR, they could go a lot taller and have more volumetric space because of that height limit. So I think that people began to realize a few years ago that, wow, I could actually, the code allows me to build this.
And then the new rental that's on the east side, that they went to 50 or something close to
that? Yeah, they've always been at 50. As a matter of fact, they originally, it was recommended by staff and the DRB approved it, the front part being at 4 stories. And then they appealed that to circuit court and lost. But then they submitted a new application a few years later, and the DRB allowed them to go to 50 without them.
Okay. But your plan is to bring this back next month, right?
Yes, I just wanted the feedback of you guys so that I can come back with something that hopefully reflects the will of the body.
Okay.
Yeah, and my sort of general feeling and policy is, you know, I'm against taking. One is it's illegal, but, you know, if people have property rights, I respect those property rights in all forms. And, you know, it would have to be a very compelling interest to even tinker with that, let alone convince me that it's legal. So with that said, then we can work around.
Mr. Chair, and I understand where you're coming from completely, and I respect that 100%. As it relates to uses, because I think that's where perhaps we may have more discretion. You know, we're talking about a single family street. Century Lane is a very small street. I mean, when we talk about having a religious institution there, or I think there's the code may even allow for a child care facility. Is that correct, Mr.?
As a conditional use, yes.
Yeah. So there are certain uses there that could generate a lot of traffic and parking demand. Are you more open to seeing us limit some of these other non-single-family residential
absolutely.
Uses?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
Great.
Absolutely.
That's the feedback
yeah.
I needed.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Great.
Can I ask you, please? How is it that this religious institution was that included in what was possible to be in that area?
In the RM1 district, religious institutions are a conditional use. And so they went to the planning board, and it was represented that the congregation primarily walks to services. And so based upon their circulation analysis, the planning board approved the conditional use approval.
Okay.
Oh.
Wait. Mr. Shim, do you want us to – I'd go. Like to make a presentation, or are you going to continue this to next month?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay. Wayne Pathman with the Law Office of the Pathman Shermer. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, commissioners, and staff. I represent the owners of lots 7 and 8 on Ferry Lane, and I agree with the discussion that you're just having with regards to the rights of the single-family homeowners. My client intends to build single-family homes. I have a quick – don't know if they could post it. Okay. Just to give you an idea of perspective of the area, because you were talking about it, you can see the character of the neighborhood has changed a long time ago. And I've been talking to Commissioner Fernandez, and I think we are aligned now in our thoughts and everything that the single-family homeowners should be able to preserve their rights to build what they have under the current code, which is 50 feet at 1.25 FAR. And I have some language that I sent. I'll just pass around real quick. Just some food for thought, some bullet points about maybe what you should consider when you come bring it back next month, which I think is in line with the current comments that the commissioners have made today, or that you have made today with regards to single-family homes would remain under the current code, and there would be further restrictions with regards to non-single-family homes and those proposed uses, as well as trying to clean up the issue of lot aggregation and traffic. So those bullet points, I think, will help you maybe come to some ultimate resolution. I'm not going to go through my full presentation because, obviously, we're coming back, but we are supportive of what Commissioner Fernandez is now proposing in connection with preserving the rights of the single-family homeowners. Thank you.
Wonderful. Are there any callers?
No callers on Zoom.
Michael, 2 minutes.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. Michael Larkin, 200 South Biscayne Boulevard, here representing the Standard Hotel. The original referral, the scope of it was to apply to the lots on Century and Ferry Lane. I acknowledge there was a re-referral that made it encompass the entire northern half of Belle Isle, but the regulations before you, it seems to me, are drafted just to apply to the lots on Century Lane and Ferry Lane. There's language in there that, however, makes it applicable to the Standard Hotel by stating it applies to all properties with a lot line on Century or Ferry, and in the northeastern corner of the Standard Hotel proper, there's about 20 feet that does touch Ferry Lane because Ferry Lane ends in a T. I don't think that was the intention of this legislation, so we're proposing an exemption for the Standard Hotel that would make it clear that it only applies to the lots that are predominantly single-family home on Century and Ferry Lanes, and Nick is passing out to you all our exemption language. But that's all I have, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. Thank you for your consideration.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear this at the next committee. Okay, great. Thanks for your comments. Thanks for this draft.
So by acclamation, I'll show this as continued to the April 19th land use.
Okay. Let's regain some traction, try to take care of a few of these. Item number 9, I think, is pretty quick. Commissioner Fernandez, this is your item, an amendment to the Alton Road Historic District buffer overlay and pharmacy regulations to accommodate the relocation of the Miami Beach Community Health Center. So I think this is a sort of a cleanup item.
It's a cleanup, and it's to accommodate what was approved
by the voters.
And so I don't know if Tom, if you have anything else to add to that.
No, I'll just mention that this was a dual referral to the Land Use Committee and the Planning Board, and it basically consists of two separate amendments. One amendment to the Alton Road Historic Buffer Overlay for some minor setback relief for buildings under 30 feet on the front and street sides only, as well as some necessary revisions to the controlled substances regulations to allow for the new location of the community health center to have a pharmacy. And the administration is in favor of the proposal.
Great. Colleagues, anything?
No, I'll move the item.
I'll second it.
Can I just ask a question?
Oh, come on up, Tim.
Good morning. I just needed clarity with this real quick. And again, I'm a pharmacist myself, so I appreciate what we need to do to help these facilities flourish and facilitate, and if we need to combine that in that facility, I have no problem with that whatsoever. I do have a quick question on 720 Alton Road. I do believe there is a build-out going on right now for a potential medical cannabis facility on that site, so I just need clarification on that, and again, the distance separations from having something across the street in the new center and this potential building that's being built out right now. Can you clarify that?
Sure. The distance separation requirements are applicable to the specific use. So the distance separation requirements are between pharmacy stores. and so it would have no bearing on a distance separation from a potential medical cannabis treatment center across the street at 740 Alton Road. There is a permit in place for a medical cannabis treatment center at 740 Alton Road, but the distance separation for medical cannabis treatment centers is specific to that use. The relief being sought here is because the proposed pharmacy does not meet the distance separation requirement from two existing pharmacies that are on 6th Street,
gotcha.
As well as the ability to locate a pharmacy within a GU district.
And if I may just add to that, what's very specific here is that this pharmacy, and just backtrack a moment, if this could be confirmed for me on the record, it applies to a medical cannabis establishment, Mr. Attorney, because under state statute, whatever law we make for a pharmacy, whatever regulation we make for pharmacy, has to be identically mirrored for a medical cannabis establishment. Is that correct?
That's right. We can treat pharmacies no more strictly than we treat medical marijuana treatment centers.
And in this case, this amendment only speaks to a pharmacy, and it talks about pharmacy requirements when it is within a government or institutional use. In other words, it can't be, CVS deciding to, lease the property and now setting up shop there, or at some medical or some marijuana establishment deciding to lease a property. It has to be part of a government or institutional use like the clinic.
That's right.
So there's no separation requirements then. That's not considered a medical pharmacy. The cannabis center that's going to propose for across the street?
Well, across the street is a medical, at 740 Alton Road is a medical cannabis treatment center, mm-hmm. but that's different than a pharmacy. And the distance separation, again, is specific to each use.
Pharmacy to pharmacy, but not to that.
Cannabis center to cannabis center.
Okay, well, that's a whole nother discussion, just that facility then. Thank you.
Which is, Tim, which is 720 West, 720 Alton, which building is that?
Where the current health center is?
Yeah.
Right north of it. It used to be
like
a tire place that's been rehabilitated. So you have that building there that's been rehabilitated. Then you have just north of that is the Federation Tower parking lot, and then 8th and Alton. So it's kind of tucked in there. Most people don't even realize it, but it is right next to the Canopy Park and everything else. So some residents are concerned.
And in there, they're putting in a cannabis store?
Exactly.
Huh. Who owns that property?
Russell Galvin.
Yeah.
I thought that property was coming down. All of that was coming down when the new office building's going up.
So did I, but it's recently, in the last 2 months, been rehabilitated, restuccoed, and everything. So I think, Tom, you know most about it.
I wouldn't want this item to go back to commission until I get more information as to what is happening at 740 Alton Road and why there is a medical cannabis establishment going in there.
I mean, he wanted to put back a couple years ago, MedMen, right? MedMen.
Well, MedMen, I believe, was proposed for 14.
Well, they went out of business, I think.
Their successor is going in the old Panera space at 14.
In the old Panera space, but don't we have distance separation?
Yes, and this one meets that distance separation.
So we're going to have two on Alton Road.
Well, actually, you're going to have three. Because
the one that's already there, yeah.
I don't want this ordinance going back to the city.
No, I agree, and I will say to his face, I'll say it on the record, Mr. Galbit promised me that he wouldn't open anymore, and now he's going to go and break that promise.
And as a community, especially the location to the park, we're going to have to rename it Cannabis Park forward.
Mr. Chair, should we defer this item till next month?
Yeah, let's defer it, and let's talk to him, because he told me specifically that he had MedMen. He had signed a lease with them, and they wanted to come in, and he asked for, us to, help that establishment open. This is going couple years ago, hasn't even opened. Don't know if he's moving forward with that, but then now we're learning mysteriously that there's yet another one opening.
I'm happy to send you photos of it if you want, because I bike ride it every day.
He made me a promise. I expect people to honor promises.
Tom, I thought you. That building was going to be raised when the new office tower is going in. I thought they need that land for the offices. Am I missing something?
The proposals that we've seen to date, and again, these are just draft proposals, leave that parcel alone in terms of the existing building, but they utilize the FAR from that parcel, but they don't propose to incorporate that lot, at least not yet, into the larger development
site. Because the other thing that I had expressed a concern about is, the parking lot that's on at the corner of 8th, and that's the reason we incorporated the 8th Street in the referendum to give FAR so that that could potentially be turned into a two-story retail so we could get rid of parking. Because I think, that's not the best use of land is to have right. a parking lot on Alton with a chain-link fence on it. So, and that was my intention, and I spoke to him about that, to have that parking replaced in the structure so that, and I remember specifically we incorporated 8th Street in the referendum for the sole purpose of being of allowing that opportunity. So, yeah, I agree with you. We need to do some more work here.
And I have the same recollection you do. I was under the impression that all that was being knocked down because they're unsightly buildings to begin with.
Right, exactly.
Why rehabilitate an unsightly building when you have the opportunity to either just knock it and make it additional parkland or do something else with it?
The if I could briefly,
yep.
And I know Mr. Fernandez, Commissioner Fernandez is looking at me, but the
name Penn, for the record, who do you represent?
Graham Penn, Burkow, Riddell, Fernandez, Larkin, Tappanus.
Are you representing Mr. Galbit?
Yes. Well, we as you know, we represent the entities, the TCH entities, which are the developers of the 500 Alton project, the 663 Alton project, which is where the new health center will be located. We don't represent Russell Aston 740 right now, but yes, just to clarify and confirm what Tom was talking about regarding the scope of the current community health center replacement site is now contemplated to include to be developed on the existing community health center plus the Floridian parking lot, with the incorporation of the 740 lot into the project, but not physically replacing the buildings on it. So the FAR from 740, portions of it will be utilized in the new project, but it will not currently is not contemplated to be demolished at this point, based on the current plan.
Does that mean that he is doing like what he did at on Alton Road, and I think it's like 16th Street, where the Dunkin' Donuts is at, that you kept the building and built over it?
It won't be as elaborate as the 1212 Lincoln.
So that means that the tenant that's going in there will be able to continue.
Correct.
And so that's the problem.
Yeah, and again, I understand the concerns related to the tenancy, but as you know, this ordinance is laser focused only across the street.
Oh no, I'm like no.
On the county
no.
facility.
No, hold up. No, I'm laser focused on what's good for the entire city.
No, I understand.
I'm laser focused that there's going to be three of these establishments going into Alton Road. Your focus is not my focus. My focus is what's good for the city.
And the only reason I'm getting up here and making a fool of myself is just to reiterate our concern regarding timing related to the county's deal, right? We need to move forward with the county exchange agreement, which will result in the creation of this building as soon as we can. So I would prefer, obviously, for us to keep rolling with all of these changes that are necessary for the health center. The issues related to 740 obviously can be continued to discuss while we come back in with the actual project, which you are going to be seeing as a development agreement. We also have the existing Alton Road Gateway overlay changes that are coming back for second reading at some point. But again, it's you obviously have the discretion to make the decisions you're making. I just want to make it clear that we have so many moving parts with this, including the county's involvement, that are incredibly important to making this project actually happen. So I prefer to deal with the 740 issues when we talk about the actual redevelopment on the west side. But again, you know.
And I think what we're telling you is we prefer not.
I understand.
Yeah, we prefer not. That's because why I think, Tom, you have this item because we need another pharmacy for the new one because this cannabis is at 740. Is that right?
No.
Or no?
No.
No, the community cell center has a pharmacy component.
Yeah.
And in order for them to relocate, they need code relief.
My concern is this is not playing out the way it was represented to me a year ago. And so I support you, Commissioner Fernandez. We've got to tap the brakes and figure this out.
Yeah, and again, we will sit with you all and take you through the revised version.
Yeah, I mean, look, for the record, that MedMen space, which is the open era building, I think, Tom, you know, when we had to make some variance allowances, the argument had been that that tenant had signed a lease because I guess you had sent or someone had sent a letter to them saying that it was a permissible use. But turns out that, you know, because of our limitations and distance separation requirements, it would not have been allowed. But somebody else had signed a lease further north on Alton Road. And so, you know, we went back and forth. And even though many of us did not want to have yet another marijuana dispensary on Alton Road, it was represented to me that the tenant had already spent like $1 million in starting the build-out construction in that Panera space. Now, that's a lie, turns out, because I had been by there not too long ago. I peeked in the window. It's all covered, but you can look in. The place is gutted. There's nothing in there. There's been no build-out, no investment in that property. So, you know, I had supported the exception simply because out of fairness, you know, this sort of issue of property rights and, you know, represented to me that the tenant in good faith had put in $1 million already in the property. It's a lie. They lied to me. So I'm going to be a lot less accommodating. When I get lied to, there's a price to pay.
We appreciate your help on that. Thank you.
So I think we're in agreement. We're going to keep the item here.
Okay, so by acclamation, we're going to continue this to the April 19th Land Use Committee.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I apologize. Tom, does this still mean that this goes to the Planning Board in March? Or does
it will. I don't believe that we can take this to the Planning Board until after Land Use makes a recommendation.
No.
Okay. All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, let's do item six then. I'll call it up, and this is your item, Commissioner Fernandez. An amendment to CD3 zoning regulations to permit convenience stores on Lincoln Road, east of Washington Avenue, subject to specific conditions. You want to present this, Commissioner Fernandez?
Sure, and thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the retail space right below the Ross on Lincoln Road. It's been a vacant piece of real estate for that I can recall at least over a decade, but no, how long? I'm being told by the representative for over 40 years. The issue that's happening here is that our definition of convenience stores is rather expansive. It's almost all-inclusive, and I think Commissioner Richardson properly stated that earlier when we were chatting about North Beach and the regulations we want to put in place in North Beach. And so this amendment would make an exception, and it would make an exception to the prohibition on convenience stores as it relates to the area east of Washington Avenue, fronting Lincoln Road, but with a minimum setback of 75 feet from Lincoln Road, because that's the unique thing about this property. This property is not right. You're walking Lincoln Road, you don't see the storefront right on Lincoln Road. You have to enter the building, walk 75 feet into the building before you actually see this storefront. I understand the importance of our regulation having to do with convenience stores. And the use that's going in there is not a 7-Eleven, it's not another CVS, it's not another Walgreens. What it is is a store called Five Below. It targets teens, and I think they also say teens and tweens. It's like a toy store for kids. It's not a Toys R Us, but it's like a toy store. We don't have any other toy store on Lincoln Road. We don't have, I believe, any other store that targets children in general on Lincoln Road. And we really want to talk about transforming Lincoln Road and being a more friendly and inviting environment. We have to think about offering stores that also cater to families and also cater to children. But most importantly, we can't have empty real estate. And that's what's happened there for 40 years. And so I respectfully request your consideration of this exception so that after 40 years, we can finally have positive economic activity happening in this vacant space. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Colleagues?
I'm supportive of this. When I met with Alfredo and the store owner, that was the Carib Theater. The bottom part has been empty for decades, and it's a massive space. The owner has done a lot to beautify the entrance of the area. The proposed store that would go in there is a companion store to Ross in a lot of other cities, and I think it would be something good for that area.
And Mr. Chair, if I just as a follow-up, I held this item from coming back to committee. Because I walked by the area. There were some things I was not happy with about the property, and I told the representative, I am not bringing this item, not allowing this item to come back to the Land Use Committee and be heard until certain improvements take place, cleanliness, painting, and other things. And they did that as well. I've been in their location. I've been in their location of all places in Winter Park, Florida, that has very high standards and very high regulations. They're kind of like Coral Gables over there, and I've never seen any bad activity coming from these stores. To the contrary, it's usually adults with children, but the constant is there's always children in these stores, and so I just wanted to place that on the record.
Yeah, look, my feeling on this, I'm not supportive. I mean, as we try to, you know, upgrade our retail experience, upgrade, you know, certain parts of our city, particularly this area of Lincoln Road, I mean, I think this is going in the opposite direction. If we're going to try to clean up this particular area east of Lincoln Road, you know, I think we should strive to try to attract, higher-end retail. That's my personal feeling on this. If you guys feel differently, then, so be it. But when you look at this mix of tenants, this is going in the opposite direction of what I think a lot of us are trying to do. It's why we, restrict, fast food joints to certain areas, why we restrict retail like we did earlier today in North Beach is to try to sort of upgrade our city. And I think, when you start getting these anchor tenants, you go the opposite route. There's no, looking at this picture, there's no mystery why we have literally, the bane of retail, like luggage stores and, cheap electronic stores next to a Ross Dress for Less. They all liked being together because they attract that clientele. I'm against it, but if you guys want to pass it, then pass it, but then don't complain when we have parts of our city, parts of our retail shopping experience attracting crowds that I think a lot of us have said we want to try to avoid.
Tom, what's the recommendation from the administration?
We are not in favor of this for a couple of reasons. I think our biggest concern is that when you allow for an exception to the convenience store prohibition, while this particular tenant, I think, might have a very interesting type of formula, potentially another convenience store could end up in that space because of the exception. We've also indicated that if this does move forward, we've suggested a few additional safeguards, including additional setbacks from Washington and Collins to ensure that there would be no corner buildings on this.
So would this be an exception for this specific space or for the block?
It would be for the two-block area, provided that the space could meet the 75-foot setback requirement from Lincoln Road. So it is specific to spaces that don't front Lincoln Road. So you would have to go through a building in order to get to it. So it's not like you're going to have a convenience store fronting it. And that would be the case moving forward. Anybody that would replace this convenience store would also have to meet the 75-foot setback requirement.
And there's, I don't think there's any other place right now that would meet that definition, right?
Well, these are deep lots, and so I don't want to say no for sure. Right. This is a very unique property with a very unique space. It doesn't appear that there are any other, at least in terms of the existing build-outs, that could do this. Down the line, if there is future build-outs, potentially somebody might be able to do it. But right now, this is the only one that we've seen that could meet the 75-foot requirement within a large enough space.
Yeah. So my concern is along the lines of what the chair was talking about in terms of this block, because we have a plan where we're going to try to pedestrianize, right? And we're trying to lift it up a little bit. And I'm looking at this picture, and with respect to the particular store, I was in the one in Tallahassee one time looking for an umbrella when it was raining. For me, it was very clean, I will say that. But it kind of reminded me of a high-end dollar store, which is probably why it has the name Five Below, $5 and below. And I'm looking at the type of stuff that is sold there. I don't really think that it's going to lift this area. I recognize the challenge from the landlord in terms of the uniqueness of the space, in terms of finding a tenant. So the question is it better left empty if you can't find another tenant, or is it better to have something like this in it? Generally, I don't think empty storefronts or I'm not sure it's a storefront because you can't see the front, but tell me about, if I could, the getting into the store. There's a lot of space you walk back. Are people loitering inside that area? Is there any security? Go ahead.
I'm happy to answer. For the record, Alfredo Gonzalez with Office at Greenberg Traurig on behalf of the property owner, 230 Lincoln MB Title LLC. It is a very unique. It's actually, I think, the only space that I could find that has this type of unique character. There's only 25 feet that front Lincoln Road. This was originally the Carib Theater, built in, I think, the 40s and the 50s. It was a lot of movie premieres, and it was about 100-foot corridor to the theater box, which is still there. And it's an open air. So you have this long walkway until you get to the actual what you consider the storefront. My client acquired this about a year ago. To give you a little brief history, this site, as far as I can recall, I remember walking in that site as a kid, maybe in the late 70s, when it was like little pop-up shops along that 100-foot corridor, not even in the theater. The theater was shut. My understanding, the theater has been shut to at least since the 70s. I think that no one had even built out that box. It still looked like a theater. I think, Tom, at one point you in your career went into there and there was still a theater. So the building was boarded up and unused for over 30 years until the early 2013 to be specific, where the then owner went through the redevelopment process of that site and finally invested the money. We went through HBB, we went board adjustment, even came to the city commission that unanimously approved the revocable permit to restore the canopy that's there. And it was built. The then owner had the signature tenant, Ross, and just so you understand, Ross Dress for Less at that location is one of their top five grossing stores in the United States. So everyone, it's not just for the tourists. My mother's there all the time. So, I mean, it attracts all types of our residents who are not looking to spend $1,000 for a pair of sneakers. And it did fix up that boarded up building for over that had been boarded up for 30 years. It went into foreclosure with COVID. They couldn't get their last tenant. The way the theater was designed, it was turned into 3 floor plates. Ross took the second and third floor. It's over 1,000 square foot floor plate. And what's remaining is the ground floor of 11,000 square feet. So it's not practical to break up into small spaces because there's really no frontage along Lincoln Road unless you walk that open corridor after the escalator, past the escalator, so you're north of 100 feet to get to the opening. The new owners took over the property, and they've been trying to maximize the, you know, occupy the space that was designed. I mean, it went through all its process before the code change that expanded the definition of convenience store. That had this happened after the fact, it would also stop Ross Dress for Less from opening. The new owners have gone in and restored what had fallen into disrepair. The landscape vertical wall has been completely restored. The irrigation system, painting, landscaping. They added more cameras. They've been working with Ross to connect to their security. In the last month alone, they've hired another security agent who is actually patrolling the area to make sure there's no vagrancy going on within that long corridor. And that's why we're pushing to fill the space. So once you have the second occupant, there's even more activity going on. And at the end of the day, Five Below is a store that, it's ironic. When I speak to individuals about the store, unless they have young children, if they have young children, everyone knows what Five Below is. Someone thought it was a liquor store, but it's not. It is for kids. It's full of household goods, things that children will use as they start, high school kids, college students early in life. They're a lot of inexpensive. Everything is not Five Below. There's Five Beyond as well. They have things when you're going to college. So that's their market, and it's really geared towards residents. It's not necessarily a tourism destination, but it's going to be used by the residents of the city and provide them another product instead of having to go to the current locations out by Miami. There's one opening in Coconut Grove or up in North Miami and having to leave the island. So in a nutshell, those are the things that we think that merit crafting this exemption. They had already built it when the code change came into place after the fact.
Okay, can I continue? So let me say, I'm looking at their website. I would not characterize this as a children's store at all. They do sell some children's items, and if you want, I can go through the long list, including pet supplies, fitness gear, you know, sports balls, best-selling books, and et cetera, et cetera. Yes, they do have children's coloring books and some other things, but this is not a children's store. I know exactly what it is because I was in one. Now, tell me what you said you had security patrol. You have somebody full-time or you have somebody
We've added someone full-time, especially in the afternoon when there was a problem. They've taken that corridor, cleaned it up, added more security cameras.
You're talking about in
that 100-foot corridor.
Right.
The 100-foot corridor that, hold on a second.
You can speak, ma'am. I think you're the owner if you'd like.
Just record.
Introduce yourself.
I'm going to. My name is Vivian Diamond. I'm the managing partner of the entity that owned the space. And to answer your question about security, we do have security guard there every day from 3 o'clock until 11 to make sure they shut the gate because the place, for some reason, because it is not very visible to the street, attracts a lot of homeless people. And frankly, they use it as a bathroom. It was a constant trouble to do that. We did receive some calls from some of the neighbors and said they do appreciate because since we have the guard there, less homeless people are going there and the city can only, I guess, take care of so many. So we would constantly call the police and we had cameras and everything. Nothing helped until we got security guard there. And I think once the space is occupied, there will be less homeless people, and we are considering keeping the guard there at all times, even if we rent downstairs, because then we can afford to keep a guard downstairs. I would like to say something about Mr. Ariola saying, you know, we're trying to upgrade. If this store is good enough to be on Fifth Avenue in New York next to Cartier and all these expensive stores, then I am sure it will fit here. They do have 1,200 stores across the United States, and this is the first time, to their amazement and shock, and frankly ours too, they are labeled convenient. When I think of convenient, I think of 7-Eleven. They are not a children's store, but they are a magnet to children. I have never been there, but since I became involved, everybody I speak to, not this lawyer, another lawyer said to me, oh my God, I should own stock in the company. My kids are there every Saturday. They buy the junk. By next Saturday, it's all broken. We start all over again. Yes, it is not a high-end store. But Ross, as Mr. Alfredo mentioned, is one of the highest gross in the country, and they are going to be there at least another 25 years. They have nowhere to go, and I am sure Cartier is not going to be interested in being downstairs, not being visible, and so on. At least it is clean, it's presentable, and it's bringing revenues to the city, and it will help us because the previous owner let it go into foreclosure.
So let me just say that, and thank you for speaking, that I know they have them all over the United States. You can't really compare ones on Fifth Avenue. I think what the chair was trying to say is if you look at this picture, we have a really strong desire to try to change the character of this block. We're even hopefully going to make it a pedestrian block. And so, if we could change other stores out, we'd like to do that as well. Let me ask Tom on this question on the security, because I think that's really important given the unique space arrangement here. And that's one of my biggest concerns. Is there a way to require, I think you said from 3 to 11 p.m. you currently have a security person dedicated to that site, right? They're not moving to other sites. They stay there. Is there a way to say that in this situation, if there's that type of setback, that this type of security would be required?
Normally, an operational condition like that would be part of a conditional use permit approval. It's difficult to codify that type of requirement. Nick, let me know if you feel otherwise, but just from a drafting standpoint, it's difficult.
I had the same thought, Tom. Would this require planning board approval?
As drafted, it does not require planning board approval.
Okay.
But if it was made a conditional use, then the planning board could certainly impose that as an operational condition.
How would that be possible? What would we do?
You could recommend that the legislation be modified so that it would become a conditional use with, those specific parameters with the minimum setback.
You want to comment on that?
I understand I gave you a rendering that has those shops next door. The rendering was from the original approval back in 2013. Yeah. Fortunately, several of those places, in a camera shop, they're gone. They're vacant. They're boarded up. So there is change going on. One of the problems that we faced and why we had to bring in security at this point was because the previous owner let it go into disrepair, right, got the first tenant, Ross, and whatever, he couldn't get secure any other tenant to that would create a marriage between the two stores. And then COVID hit. It became a very easy place for people to, vagrants to come in. One of the things that they also did in addition to hiring security, they went through that corridor, like there were open spaces behind the escalator, so people were hiding and spending the whole day there and doing all kinds of things. So that was boarded up. They're going to close it out, so you couldn't have that. They added the additional security cameras, and they brought the property back to the original standards that it was approved under. So, like I said, the landscape wall, they had to come out and find special cherry-picking machines that could fit in that narrow corridor. They had to redo the whole irrigation system. A portion of the landscape was good, but more than half of it had died out because no one had maintained it prior to their control. So as a fully operational building, the issues that we've seen over the last couple of years go away with or without a security guard parked. If there's a need for one, they would put one. There is a, for your record, when they are closed, they do, that corridor is closed, a gate comes down, so after hours, people can't walk up and down that that corridor.
I have a question.
May I just say one last thing about the security? The city did not ask us to do that. We did it because we want to improve the place. We want to keep it nice and clean. And we will do our part. But you need to help us. We cannot afford to have this place sitting empty. It's almost 12,000 square feet. And that's part of the reason why it went in foreclosure the first time.
If I may, right now, if this proceeds as a permitted use, or an exception to the prohibited uses, then a different, let's say, convenience store, what we define as a convenience store, could go in there.
Correct.
As of right.
Correct.
If we make this a conditional use, how would it be different? So let's say five and below goes in there. Let's say five and below gets sold, and let's say Home Goods, you know, buys five and below, then Home Goods can go in there because it's the same entity, I guess.
Correct. As currently drafted. Now, if it's a conditional use, any new operator would have to go back to the planning board and have their CUP.
New operator being an entity gets purchased.
Correct.
But okay. But let's say five and below they go out of business or the lease, there's an end to the lease, then someone wouldn't automatically be allowed. A convenience store wouldn't be automatically allowed in the space. They would have to go through an approval process.
Correct. They would. Any new operator would have to go back to the planning board and go through the CUP process.
If it's conditional use, but correct. The way it's drafted now,
correct.
You know, Five Below could move out and 7-Eleven could move in.
Correct.
You know, and
except they're there already.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
So listen, I'm never going to hold up something in committee for another member. I'm would be willing to move this back to the commission without a recommendation one way or the other, if that's what you want to do. I would prefer that this be done with a conditional use because I want to continue the security, because I don't want to give you the approval and then you say, okay, we don't need security anymore. And I want that security there. I want the gate to come down at 11. I want the gate to come down. I don't want to approve this and then a year from now find the gate's not coming down because the security person's not there and there's no one there to go pull the gate down. And then we have a situation. It's just the uniqueness of this space where people can literally live inside this vestibule area.
And through the chair, I think this is wise thinking of you, Commissioner Richardson. In the past, I remember one of the first items that I worked on the planning board was, I believe, a Target. And part of what Target had to do was bring forward an operational plan, that spoke about many things, including safety, including their gates and cleanliness and the number of employees that they had and that type of stuff. And I think this is reasonable. It'll be great. And I'm not a voting member of this committee. So, but this does make its way to the planning board to hear from the planning board what they feel, because this was a dual referral to this committee and to the planning board, and to see from the planning board, do you believe it should be an exception as presented here, or should it be a conditional use, and get their feedback on that. The one thing I have to say is the one thing we hear over and over and over again from our law enforcement, those trying to improve the city, positive activity. The lack of activity is what attracts the negative. It's what attracts drug dealers. It's what attracts everything we're trying to solve in some of these areas. Here we have a property owner that, after 40 years, is finally willing to get a tenant in there. Convenience stores, the real convenience stores are already in that block. We already have CVS, I think, is right there. 7-Eleven is right there. And by the crowd, by the way, the crowd at 7-Eleven, I never feel safe walking by. And I go by there every single day. I walk by there every single day. I do not feel safe going by that 7-Eleven. This property owner, I reached out to their representative. I told them I don't like how the building is painted. They painted it. I told them I don't like the lighting situation. They addressed the lighting situation. I told them I don't like how the gate was crooked. They addressed the gate. They addressed the issue with the landscape wall. They addressed the issue of the grime on the windows because it's a new property owner. We need to help them succeed because they're not in the easiest part of our city. They're in the part of our city that needs help. And the only way we can change that is filling empty space with positive activity. So I would support you if I were voting here, I would support you. And we could send this back to commission, even without a recommendation, but as well to the planning board so that they tell us, should it be the exception or should it be the conditional use?
Can I make one comment? Would the committee consider recommending it as a conditional use? Because we're scheduled, there was a dual referral, so we're going to the planning board, I think, next month to hear this item. And rather than have no recommendation from the committee, I think it would be positive to say, and we're supportive if it wants to be, it should be a conditional use, if it's tweaked to be conditional. So you have this operational plan, they could look at security to make sure the gate closes at the proper time. All those factors could be evaluated as the planning board typically would do. And if that's the direction of this committee, and I understand that's one of your concerns, Commissioner, we would be happy if the recommendation would be supportive of the recommendation going to the planning board as a, it should be a conditional use where they look at these factors, security, gate, however you want to phrase it.
So let me say that I am only going to support this as a conditional use here and if it makes it to a final vote in the commission. I can't support it any other way because I am going to insist upon, you may have the votes elsewhere, I don't know, but I'm going to insist upon the security issues and the gate on these operational issues.
And I agree with
that. Because I think that's important. So,
and
you don't have to insist on it. We insisted on it before I ever got here on our own, and I have no problem in keeping it. Because I don't want also Five Below to say we thought this is high-end Miami Beach and we get nothing but blah, blah, blah. They can always cancel out.
The problem is that, and I believe everything you're telling me, but you and your partners may sell the property in 5 years, and then I'm dealing with somebody else that owns it that may not have your same sense of commitment to the community.
Well, if you do approve it, we will not sell the property. We are happy to stay, so work with us. I'm sure there is some kind of agreement or something we can sign that it will run with the land or the building or whatever you want to call it. Because security is very important.
Commissioner, I like the approach in which this has been discussed. This is the positive thing about having these discussions at committee. There's good outcomes. And I think that this is a measured approach. We're helping a piece of real estate that's been empty for decades get filled, but setting in place the proper protections for the safety and the cleanliness and the appearance of this area that we want to see revitalized. And so, Commissioner Richardson, thank you for that amendment because I would support it, as you've stated, at the commission as well.
Yeah, I would love it if this would be a Cartier or a Tiffany, but that's never going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. So let me just weigh in. Look, I mean, had I been on the commission, you know, way back when, I would not have approved a Ross Dress for Less. You know, this is a very challenging part of Lincoln Road.
Yeah.
Everyone says they feel unsafe. I certainly feel unsafe. It's dirty. You got bad tenants. You got riffraff there. And a lot of that has to do with the activation that was created before any of us sat on this commission, that just lack of foresight and planning. And that has happened on Lincoln Road to the west. I mean, if you look at, you know, all of the store vacancies that have occurred there, it's because of, you know, prior commissions' lack of planning and foresight. You know, fortunately, a year or two ago, we were able to stop Walgreens from opening on Lincoln Road. The same arguments we're hearing today were made then. But, like, once these AAA-rated tenants, and these are AAA-rated tenants, these are publicly traded entities, get a foothold, then you're never going to get anybody else opening next to them. The reason Ross, you know, has sat empty, these other places, because a lot of stores don't want to be next to Ross, right? So if you go to any strip mall, across America, you will always find a Five Below next to a Ross, next to a Hobby Lobby, next to an Ulta Beauty. These guys all congregate together. Like, literally, developments are built with these tenants in mind, and they all cluster together. And you're never going to find, higher-end retailers, because they don't want to be around this. So, you know, you will see a Subway open up next to this, and you will continue to see luggage stores and this kind of tenant. So we're going to basically be condemning this part of Lincoln Road to this kind of tenants in the future. That's just a fact. So if we want to sort of reclaim Lincoln Road for mom and pops, and we want to reclaim Lincoln Road for, idiosyncratic type stores and not be a suburban shopping mall, then, you know, we'll draw a hard line and say no to folks like we did with Walgreens in the past. Or we'll say, okay, Ross Dress for Less, you can have Five Below. And then this part of Lincoln Road is gone. It'll be gone for 30 years or more because these guys all have staying power. And what building owners typically like to do is load up tenants with AAA rated tenants and then flip the property. I'm not saying you're going to do that, but that is what happens, right? It's like once you get AAA rated tenants with 30-year leases, they become really attractive to REITs, and they get flipped. That's exactly what happened on Lincoln Road, right? All the mom and pops were displaced by, you know, big Gap stores or whatever, and then all those properties flipped at incredibly high rates. And then, of course, even those tenants can't afford those rents anymore. And then they close, and they stay dormant because the property is traded at such high values that nobody can move in and nobody wants to take the write down. So I'm gonna be a no on this for that very reason. I have a vision for the city, and we have to say no to fine folks to try to get to where we want to go. The reason this, you know, this part of the reason this thing is stuck right now, in addition to the floor plate argument and the way the building's laid out, is you have a Ross Dress for Less there. Only certain types of tenants want to be associated with that.
Can I just ask, Chair, and good points. Let me ask you, how long is your lease with Ross?
Altogether, we calculated this morning another 25 years.
Another 25 years. Yes. So
they have renewals.
So, and I understand your concerns, and I think you're coming from a very good place, because I know your vision. And your vision is to improve this city. I just can't allow a space on Lincoln Road to stay vacant for another 25 years because Ross is there, and that's going to be the challenge. Is, you know, do we allow something to go forward, or do we keep it empty, condemned by Ross? And I don't feel comfortable with that. But thank you, colleagues. This has been a great discussion. I think we've improved this item as it moves forward in the legislative process. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have three callers on Zoom.
Okay.
Who's the first caller is Danny Dominguez.
Danny Dominguez, you're up.
Yeah, I raised my hand earlier. I had a comment like Vivian said about the security that we've hired and how it improved the area. I'm with the landlord group and the property management group on my side. Just to make the comment of the gate that was being concerned, the security guard, the store closes at 10:30, and so the security guard does not leave until that gate closes, and the Ross employees have left the corridor area. So that is confirmed. It is only reopened by the cleaning company that comes in the morning. They come in, close the gate, do their cleaning, and then close the gate again. So there's a specific protocol not solely done by us, but also approved and oversaw by Ross as well. So we're doing it together. Just wanted to reiterate that comment. And
Danny, quick question for you. How it works. The security, that's part of CAM, so it's passed through to Ross?
Passed through to CAM at this point for their percentage of ownership or their percentage of the building, which is 58% of the building. We also have the rooftop space that I don't think has been addressed, so that's why that's also considered – which is vacant.
Just so my colleagues understand, right? So they're not, the property owner and the property management is not doing this out of the goodness of their heart. They're not going to be opposed to a conditional use permit because they can tell the tenant, the city's requiring us to have this security. It's part of CAM, Common Area Maintenance, and it's passed through to you. And, you know, Ross and Five Below have the financial capacity to absorb that. But this is not like a big favor to us. They just pass this right over to the tenants.
I'm sorry, I disagree.
We do, but at this point, we are
58%.
So 42%.
What I'm saying is actually true. I know you got to do what you got to do, but don't try to fact check me on facts. That is true. It is passed through to Cam. Danny just said it. That's why I asked Danny and not you. Who's next? You're not going to absorb the security costs.
The only comment I want magazine. To make, the only comment I'm going to make, don't say it's not out of the goodness of your heart. It was our idea. We started it. And Ross
because
said
your
it's
tenant
great.
Would want it. They don't want vagrants scaring their customers away. You had to do it.
Sir, I'm not going to argue with you, but I disagree with you. So do whatever you have to do.
Really? So if Ross says to you, hey, we have vagrants standing in front of our store, you have to provide security. Of course you're going to do that.
They did not do that. We provided security before they said or asked for anything. That's right. The point.
But you charge them for it.
No, not yet.
Danny just
way.
Said you passed 58% of the cost
planning
to the tenant.
Planning to, but it have not happened yet because the whole security idea was my idea as the owner because every
so
time...
So you don't... So Danny was wrong in saying that you passed through
I said
the security?
It has not. It's going to be. It all happened recently.
Oh, so this is recent.
The security is about, what, Danny, a month or two?
You might inform your tenant that going tit for tat with me is probably not wise if...
Just,
if
okay. Don't worry about it.
Joseph Magazine is our next caller.
Joseph, you're up. Joseph.
Joseph, can you unmute yourself?
Yeah, yes, thank you. While not opining on this specific usage here, I would just make a friendly suggestion that maybe we piggyback this on the discussion from earlier, looking at areas of the city that are kind of ripe for a little bit more of residential housing and residential development. It's been my long-held belief that we have problems filling the vacancies on Lincoln Road. Last that I heard was 35 vacancies because we lack full-time residential housing that can economically support that a retail quarter in the immediate surrounding walkable area. If you look at areas of our city that are just primed to be your live-work-play district, I think this is one of them. Of course, that was the goal with the Lincoln Road lots. I don't want to get into political back and forth about why or why that didn't pass, but if we're looking at areas that could kind of foster or facilitate a bit more residential housing, I think this would be the prime area, and that would actually help economically support our struggling retail quarter. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I would have done with the property had Ross not been there. They came, I would have said, well, you know, how can we help you redevelop this into something else? But it's too late for that because they have a 25-year lease and then some. But who's the next caller?
Our last caller is Daniel Seraldo.
Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, commissioners. This is a very important discussion. I'm on Ocean Drive right now, and I remember when this commission had the foresight to limit the proliferation of franchises. I think if that hadn't been done several years ago, we would have had McDonald's and other things that really could have further impacted the brand. So, you know, I understand the interest in having any tenant possible, but I agree with Commissioner Arriola in this case that we've got to keep these regulations in place. I also, that 7-Eleven is one of the scariest places I've ever seen. And the idea that we'd have another one right nearby in the most busy foot traffic block of the entire county is a little bit scary. So I think it does require that additional thought. Thank you.
Thanks. Anybody else?
We have no more callers.
All right, so colleagues, where are we at? So Commissioner Dominguez.
So I will move the item back to the commission with a recommendation on conditional use. I wish it could be a Cartier. It's not. Wait a minute. Let me finish. I am not going to support this if it's not conditional use. And I want all these operational things, including security. And I get the pass-through. You're 100% right. But to be honest, I don't care who pays for it. I don't care who pays for it as long as it's there.
They're secure.
If they want to charge their tenant, I don't care. If I were the landlord, I would charge my tenant, right? So as long as these operational things are taken care of and it's conditional use, I'm going to support it because I feel like I can't have a Cartier there. It's not going to be a Tiffany. And so I have a choice of leaving it empty for 25 years or putting something there. And the best I can do right now is to have it occupied with some conditional use and some operational restrictions. And so I'll move that. I know, Chair, that you're not going to support that. And So we'll have to hear from Commissioner Dominguez.
Yeah, Commissioner Dominguez.
I don't like seeing empty storefronts either. I also agree with Commissioner Areola that we would love to see something more upscale there. But given that Ross has a lease for 25 years, this is the companion store, and all of the items that the landowner has committed to, I'm supportive of it.
So, Tom, I would also, when it gets back to the commission, if you could work with the sponsor and also to let us know what percentage of food products, because that's something else that, you know, I may want to. I know all about this definition of convenience store because of the GoPuff, and, you know, it. We do have a very, very expansive definition, and it does cause some of these issues, but... Yeah. So,
can I ask you a procedural question? Right. Just thank you, Mr. Chair. So would the recommendation be, because it's going to the planning board, so I know you keep saying going back to the commission, would it go?
Was it a dual referral?
It was a dual referral already. So,
okay.
And we would be supportive if the recommendation from this committee was to the planning board that it should be a conditional use. We would, at the planning board, support that amendment, and then hopefully if the planning board recommends it, it would come back to the commission as a conditional use, fully understanding if it's
not. If it was a dual referral, we could do that. Now, the only question is, do I want you to work on some of these operational things before it goes to the planning board, or do you want to work on them with the planning board?
The operational conditions are typically imposed as conditions of the CUP order. So if the commission approves this amendment at second reading to allow this use set 75 feet back as a conditional use, they would then have to make a separate application to the planning board, and then at that point the planning board would impose those operational conditions.
But we can send this to the planning board from here, right?
Correct, but just for the ordinance amendment.
Yeah, exactly. But we would amend it to say the ordinance would be a conditional use.
Correct. Instead of the exception to prohibited uses, a new draft with a new title would be presented to the planning board that would make this a conditional use. There would still be the 75-foot setback requirement.
And then if the planning board would then send it to the commission, then we would vote on it.
Correct.
And then if we give it a positive, then they would have to make an application to the planning board.
Correct.
To get the conditional use.
That's correct.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
I think you've made great recommendations here, and I'm fine with my item being amended as such. And I just have one last question, just as it relates to prohibited uses. Do we prohibit fast food establishments on Lincoln Road?
No.
No? So that's why Rice and Cane's went into that corner there of Washington. And that could in the future then be like a Burger King or anything else. Yeah. And so.
Yep. So bring it. We limit chains, though, right?
No, there was a proposal to have the only areas that we limit chains are Sunset Harbor and then the larger Ocean Drive Art Deco MIMO area. There was a proposal to study a formula ordinance on Lincoln Road, but the bid was adamantly opposed to it.
Yeah. And so if you want to sponsor it, I'll co-sponsor with
sure,
you.
Sure, let's work on it.
I thought we had some restrictions on chains on Lincoln Road, so I'm wrong about that. So we should.
I mean, Denny's is going in Washington Avenue. I mean,
yeah. Again, those property owners, like all property owners, want the highest and best economic use for them. So their vested interest is maximizing their economic interest. Our job as elected officials is to create a great city. And my opinion, I was elected twice, is Lincoln Road and certain areas of our city should not be inundated with fast food joints and chains.
Right.
We did it on Ocean Drive and we did it in Sunset Harbor. I thought we had a little bit more restrictions going on Lincoln Road. But I can see those property owners saying, no, we want to have a AAA rated tenant that'll ruin Lincoln Road forever because they signed 30-year leases. But hey, I'm going to make a lot of money and I'm going to flip this and go home. We have to draw a hard line and sometimes tell our friends, no, you're not. I took a lot of heat for helping get rid of Walgreens on Lincoln Road, but if Walgreens had been there, we'll never get another high-end establishment on Lincoln Road, and that whole block would have been devastated for 30-plus years. So, Commissioner Fernandez, if you want to bring something
I'll co-sponsor it.
If staff would work on a draft legislation and be with me on it, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, there's I think that Rob from the city attorney's office worked on the last iteration for Sunset Harbor pretty closely because we had to be very careful about the constitutional issues associated with chains. So on this one, on number six, this will show as Commissioner Richardson as maker of the motion, Commissioner Dominguez as a second, to send this to the planning board as a conditional use instead of as an exception to prohibited uses.
And with operational guidelines and restrictions, I want specifically the security and some of the other things we talked about.
We'll include the minimum operational conditions that would be required by the planning board.
Maintenance of that outside area, if there are plants and things like that,
Okay, and then we'll show this approved 2-1. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. You have a stop at 2:15? 12:15?
I do.
Okay, so let's take up item number 5, which is the last of the action items. Discuss increasing allowable floor area ratio for workforce housing. We talked about this at the last committee meeting. Tom, I'm going to turn it over to you. I'll just sort of reintroduce this to colleagues, which is, do we have an appetite and interest in putting before the voters a ballot question that would allow for increase in FAR specifically tailored for workforce housing? And if so, what would be the appropriate FAR increase? Would we have a sunset provision? Would we target certain areas, et cetera? So this is a bit of a companion item to, as I was saying earlier, items 2 and 3, which is, again, planning for what we want for our city, for the coming several decades. We want to have more workforce housing. We need the tools to do that. One of those tools would be to allow development to have additional floor area ratio. With the stipulation that it'd be very specific for workforce housing with the conditions that, this body would impose on such a development and would be voted upon by the voters.
Okay. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair, on this. In the memo, my staff did some really good research on how other jurisdictions incentivize workforce and affordable housing through percentages of increase in allowable intensity and density. And one of the reasons that increases in intensity and in density are so critical to develop tangible amounts of workforce housing is because by their nature, they're not generating the same level of income. And when you're dealing with a city like Miami Beach, where the land costs are so high, the ability to build additional units becomes critical to being able to make the numbers work, so to speak. The memo identifies some different options for FAR bonuses for workforce and affordable housing. Typically, it's a percentage increase above and beyond what the current maximum FAR in a district is, and that increase can be utilized for workforce housing and affordable housing. It can be mandated only for that. The other option would be as part of an FAR bonus increase, depending upon the increase, a certain portion of that increase could also be used for market housing in order to really incentivize developers to max out the amount of workforce and affordable housing that can be built. As I'm sure you're aware, under state law, localities are preempted from imposing workforce and affordable housing mandates unless they contain a companion incentive to offset the cost of providing workforce and affordable housing. So typically, intensity and density bonuses are good at that. With regard to voter approval, obviously voter approval is required for any type of increase in FAR. And typically what you would want to do is identify those areas of the city that would be well established for FAR increases and that could best accommodate workforce and affordable housing through through intensity bonuses. And when those have been identified, one advantage to this over something like, say, a TDR is that you're not relying on the private sector to facilitate a private transaction to increase the FAR. Instead, you're actually giving the FAR to developers who are willing to come in and build workforce housing now. So there is an advantage in terms of it happening probably more expeditiously by having an FAR overlay for workforce and affordable housing. As is the case with TDRs, there is a timing component because voter approval is required and the approval of a ballot question would have to occur by July.
Colleagues?
So I'm supportive of this as it relates to workforce housing, but I think given that it's going to go before the voters, I like the model that we discussed in number two with transfers. So I don't know if these can be put together. I don't know, Tom, if the board decides to put this to the voters, if we can do TDRs and this in the same item, or if it would have to be two different. I worry that if we have too many FAR-related questions on the ballot, that it causes confusion and concern, and one may topple the other one. So could it be? Could
typically, they're two different types of tools. And so a TDR is very specific to moving allowable FAR to a receiving district. I think it would be difficult to put that into the same question, particularly since we're only limited to 75 words. I think if there was a proposal for just a flat FAR increase within certain districts that have been identified, that's probably better off as a separate ballot question.
And so I would be more supportive of number two because I think it'll be easier to sell to the voters. Because I think they may see this just a FAR increase, and there's no. I really like the conversation we were having about the, you know, taking the FAR from a historical area and requiring them to put that back into either restoration or sustainability of their property.
And point very well taken. Let me editorialize for a second on this. Look, I think these are true companion items, but if they're going to pass, you know, this really has to be supported 7-0 by the commission, or at least 6-1. And it has to be a real plan that has to be presented to voters. And, like, this is the plan for the future. If we're serious about workforce housing, these are tools. These are the safeguards so that this isn't misused. And those safeguards can include, you know maximum FAR that we're capping. Put it in certain areas. We can have sunset provisions. We can be very specific about what the definition of workforce housing, all of that. But it has to be a grand plan that's presented to voters and that they fully are educated and comfortable with and then support. That's why I worry about the fire bombers who come in at the 11th hour and just derail all this effort. But we have to do something about workforce housing. It is becoming more and more unattainable. That's just not going to reverse itself. We have to take proactive measures to get there. So, you know, hopefully we can all get on board. And to your point, whether we do this as a package or piecemeal, I'm okay. But I'm done in November. Somebody will have to pick this up and say, look, right now we're going to do TDRs because that's a tool, limited, but it's a tool. And then somebody's going to have to come back with FAR for workforce housing next year or the year after if we're going to be serious about it. I don't know what the ballot in November is going to look like. None of us do. But there's going to be more items than just these potentially. And then we have the risk of voters getting confused or frustrated and just saying no to everything. There is, and it's just a prediction. We'll see. I think I'm pretty good at predictions. There's going to be intense lobbying against any of this from the development community because there are certain developers, some of which didn't do so well this last November, who are already lobbying to get their item come this November, and they want only their item on there. So they don't want us to do our jobs on behalf of residents. They want their project alone to be on the ballot so that they can, you know, build support for it. So we're going to get intense lobbying from a lot of groups, not the least of which will be, oddly enough, the development community that don't want a crowded ballot so they can try and get their one specific project through. So just prepare yourself for that. Commissioner Dominguez, do you have any?
I agree that this should be a companion item to the other, because I also worry, as Commissioner Richardson mentioned, about too many FAR items on the ballot. We do need to do something as a city to have more affordable housing. And during my campaign, I met with several developers who had told me they can't do it unless they have some sort of incentive. So I think it's on the right track. I also, I do worry that we've heard, and we may have several developments already approved and ready to get built that are designated as workforce housing, and none have been built yet. So I just want to make sure, I think you may have mentioned there might be a max, or somebody mentioned that there could be a max number that we do. I don't want to have too many out there given the number that are already approved to be built and nothing's been built yet.
I think you might be referring to the micro units, the smaller units, which are workforce housing. I think that's because those are capped. Right. Yeah, the reason I'm editorializing a little bit is because I need, I really truly believe that this is the path forward and this is good for our city. Voters may disagree, but at least we'll know what voters think with respect to workforce housing, because we hear it time and time again. What I have seen is that everybody wants workforce housing, but not in their backyard. That's typically what derails a lot of projects. Like, we all want mass transit, but not in my backyard. Everybody wants, something, but not in their backyard. And the problem is, we have to plan for an entire city. Sometimes we're just going to, not please everybody. So that's why, having broad support and co-sponsors on legislation is really important. I bring a perspective and my colleagues bring another perspective, but if we do things on a united front, we have a much higher chance of success. Commissioner Dominguez, if you're interested in any of this co-sponsoring, I would relish that, because I think you bring a certain voter bloc that's different from mine, and if we unite on some of these things, we'll get these things passed. Not to put you on the spot, but let's just be real. Let's just be real. That's why I asked Commissioner Fernandez on the Lincoln Road item, because, that's how things will get passed. Everything here is going to be a close vote, and that's how they divide us, by keeping us divided on items. But if we come together, we'll get a lot of things done. And then stop playing political games. Not that you play any, you don't. You're wonderful. But not true of all of our colleagues. Okay, so we'll keep this here in committee and talk about it some more. But if we're serious about this, whether we want to do this now in November or in a future ballot, I think it behooves us to explore this and start talking about it with our community. Because, as you said, developers will tell you they cannot build workforce housing here for lots of reasons, principally because of cost. And if we can help amortize costs over more units through an increase in FAR, we'll bring the cost down. There's other things we can do, such as parking, such as development around transit-oriented zones, continued emphasis on mixed-use projects. That's why I'm been pushing so hard on office use here in the city, so people don't have to get in their cars and drive to work. Okay.
Do you want to continue this to the June meeting as well for updates?
Maybe May.
May? Okay.
All right. We have, Commissioner Richardson, you have to leave. Is there any item you want to hear? We have a bunch of discussion items, and I can stick around for a little longer and we can get a few of these done. The rest are Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez and Commissioner Fernandez. I don't know if he's coming back. Commissioner Dominguez, do you want to hear any of these in particular? You and I can hash out a few of these. Some of these are innocuous.
I think this one, Commissioner Minor, said he wanted us to hear this.
Commissioner Minor wanted to hear item 10. Happy to hear. We still have time. Discussion about creating a 6th Street overlay between Washington Avenue and Alton Road.
And I can, Mr. Chair, I can go ahead and take that one up. I did talk to Commissioner Minor earlier, and he said, if time permitted, that we could go ahead and hear this item.
This item was discussed last at the January meeting, at which time the committee continued it to this meeting and directed staff to take a look at different incentives that could potentially be included to move FAR from the south side of 6th Street or properties closer to the south side of 6th Street and move that southward closer to properties that are either fronting the north side of 5th Street or closer to the north side of 5th Street. And there's basically two ways that you could do that. One would obviously be a voter-approved TDR program that would allow people to take FAR from lots that may front directly on 6th Street and transfer it within a receiving district in that block or within the overlay. The other way would be through a covenant in lieu of unity of title to create a larger aggregated development site. And as long as the lot lines are touching, the FAR from lots that are either close to 6th Street or fronting 6th Street that is available could be moved to another part of the lot that would either be in the mid part of the block or closer to 5th Street. Some of the other incentives to encourage those types of aggregations would be include relief from the CUP process for 50,000 square foot buildings, height increases for that portion of the building where the additional FAR is going to be moved over to, and a corresponding reduction in height for the properties closer to 6th Street, since ostensibly they wouldn't have as much FAR. Perhaps additional types of uses that are not permitted within the area, such as artisanal retail and experimental retail. The remainder of the item remains the same with regard to the draft overlay. The administration does believe that it could move back to the full commission for consideration for a referral to the planning board if it's the will of this committee. And that's the only update I have.
And what is the recommendation on the height from the administration?
Based upon the current overlay, we're recommending that the height remain at 50 feet, even for smaller properties fronting 6th Street. And we're also recommending that that 50-foot height increase be limited to the first two lots, regardless of use. So even if somebody's proposing a residential or a hotel use, we believe that that is a more effective way of distributing the maximum allowable FAR. Once you're set back from 6th Street, you could potentially go up to 75 feet.
What does that mean, set back? So you're talking about on the like this back half of the lot?
Correct. And let me read you exactly what we put in the draft development regulations. The maximum permitted height within the first two platted lots south of 6th Street shall not exceed 50 feet regardless of property use. So basically, the first two lots that would be fronting the side streets and certainly the lot fronting 6th Street, you could go up to 50 feet regardless of use. Once you get past two platted lots, you could potentially go to 75 feet if you were proposing a residential or hotel use. And any new construction would also require the review and approval of the Historic Preservation Board, who obviously is going to take a very close look at overall building height and that distribution of volume.
So does that mean if a developer wanted to be on 5th Street but then move north to 6th Street, they could use part of, part of the northern side behind whatever the dividing line would be. I don't think there's an alley there, but and then they would have to step down to 50 feet once they get to 6th Street. Is that right?
Yeah, if somebody had a large aggregated site, say on the east side of Jefferson Avenue, let's say they aggregated all the lots on the east side of Jefferson Avenue between 5th Street and 6th Street, and they proposed a brand new development. If the first two platted lots from 6th Street, which is basically the first 100 feet, they would be limited to 50 feet there. But once they got past that, they would be at 75 feet if they were doing residential hotel, which is the current height limitation.
And what about, I think at one time we had said we were thinking about office, but it would just be residential and hotel, or could it also be office?
You could add office as one of those uses that could avail themselves of the higher height. Right now, under the code, the only uses that are permitted to go above 50 feet are residential or hotel, but you could add that as a suggestion to the overlay that office uses also be allowed to go to 75 feet.
And what about, we had also talked about limiting some uses. Is that included in this as well?
Yes, we do have a proposed limitation on a number of uses, including the nuisance uses that we've talked about in the past, and specifically these include the following uses shall be prohibited: the sale, lease, or rental of any motor vehicles, including but not limited to automobiles, golf carts, low-speed vehicles, mopeds, motorcycles, and motor scooters, hostels, convenience stores, smoke shops and vape stores, package stores, and the retail sale of alcohol for off-premise consumption.
And so on the convenience stores, what is it? The existing ones would be?
They would become legal nonconforming.
And what about, there are a couple of grocery stores there as well, but is that different from
a convenience? Yes, grocery stores are defined separately from convenience stores. They would not be affected.
Yeah. So, and you think this is ready to go back, it could go back to the commission?
Yeah, it would need to go back to the commission for a referral to the planning board.
Yeah. So, colleagues, I still think that it needs a little bit of work, but I don't know that we need to complete that all here right now, and I would be willing to send it back to the commission and have it referred to planning. I do think there's a need for an overlay. I'm not sure I'm in agreement with everything that's here right now. I think it still needs some more work, but I think that work can be done. When sending it back to the commission, we may want to add a few amendments or after it comes back from the planning board, but I'm prepared to move it back to the commission.
Mr. Dominguez?
Yes, I agree. And what I like is that the Flamingo Park Neighborhood Association has given a lot of input every step of the way. And this has been ongoing since the end of 21. So I'm supportive of moving it to the commission.
And Mr. Chairman, we have one caller on Zoom.
Sure.
Johan Moore.
Okay, Johan, you're on.
You have 2 minutes.
Morning, good afternoon, I believe, not by now, commissioners. I'll let you go to lunch. I just want to say that I was so heartened and inspired by the conversation around the transfer of development rights this morning. And I simply want to say that I think our proposed protections for 6th Street in no way contradict that broader and very inspiring vision, irrespective of how neighborhood associations may come down on that or how the commission may choose to proceed on that. Thank you all very much for your attention to the Flamingo Park Neighborhood Association's efforts to protect 6th Street. We hear that there are outstanding issues, and I want to make clear that we have various potential areas where we would be willing to compromise, especially for low to moderate income and workforce housing. And so I thank everyone for their comments and their efforts in those respects today. Thank you all.
Thank you. Okay, anything else?
No other callers.
Okay. I know you have to leave. Okay. Commissioner Dominguez, if you can do 5 minutes, maybe we can knock out a couple of these. We'll try to take some innocuous ones.
So for the 6th Street overlay, I'm sorry I missed the last conversation, is the direction to refer the administration version to the commission for referral to the planning board? Okay. By acclamation? Okay.
Okay. I have an item here for discussion, which is item 15. I don't know if Monica from Parking is here who wants to discuss this. We discussed this, I don't know if it was in the committee or in the full commission, about EV parking requirements and new developments. This has to do with new developments. I had, another comment just within our own parking garages, city-owned parking garages. But, clearly EVs are, they're rapidly becoming – very, very popular globally. They're at 10% and really growing even faster than in our country. I think our penetration rate now is 5%, but that will quickly go up. States like California are mandating
or prohibiting internal combustion engines by the year 2030. In order to get ahead of this, what do we want to do, if anything, about new developments that are coming online of any sort to mandate EV charging stations as part of new developments? I, for one, feel that they should be mandated. I don't know what the right number would be, but we're going to, find ourselves in a crisis before long if we don't address it. So anything coming online, to what extent do we have a requirement that EV parking charging stations be part of a development project?
I'm fully supportive of this, and I agree with you that the numbers are growing exponentially quicker than people had anticipated. I believe the state currently has a law where if somebody lives in a building, they can request access to electricity in their unit, and the owner bears the cost. Many units on Belle Isle where I buildings on Belle Isle where I live, some have charging stations by consumption. Others are still evaluating how to upgrade their electricity grid. So I'm fully supportive of this in ensuring that any new developments have the electrical capacity in their initial builds in order to have EV stations, and give owners the option of either having it at their parking spots or in a communal area.
Yeah, I just think unless we address this and unless we require it in new developments, we're only going to be shifting the problem to us, because people will need to charge their cars. The market is headed that way. I think there's a federal requirement that by a certain, it's 2030,
different states, like California is probably the most extreme example. They're going to ban the sale of internal combustion engines, right, by the year 2030. So you can't even sell a new gas-powered car in that state. That's probably the most dramatic. Lots of incentives at the federal level to go EV. And then, obviously the manufacturers are pumping these things out like crazy now, and consumers are buying them. As an EV owner, I will tell you, if you live in an apartment that was built before 2021, there are no charging stations as part of the building. And then in order to charge, you have to go to a city garage some other private charging station, most of which are not on Miami Beach, most of which are across the bay. In order to not compound the problem, what do we want to do for new developments to require that they have, as part of their application process, EV charging stations?
Listen, and I think the reality is that every parking space, I mean, to me, it just any required parking space, at least for residential buildings, need to be wired to provide for electric charging. You can choose whether to put the plug there or not. I mean, I don't know. I would seek professional guidance in this, but we just know that the market is heading that way, especially with the federal incentives and all that. So I agree with you, Ricky. I think we should be wiring these new developments to provide this, and it only makes sense. You don't do it partially. If you're doing required parking for residents, looking into the future, we just should require each one of these new parking spaces to be out retrofitted or to have the proper wiring to accommodate electric charging.
Tom, you have any insight on how we might do this?
Yeah,
do you have any
currently
guidance on what other municipalities might be doing?
Currently, under the code, we have a requirement that, with the exception of single-family homes, 2% of all parking spaces within new construction have to be EV spaces. One of the things that we suggested in the memo was that, one, you could increase that from 2% to 5%. Other cities are going to the 5% standard. The other thing is, as Commissioner Fernandez indicated, was you could create a mandatory requirement that regardless of whether or not you actually put a charging station, that you put the wiring for it so that it's very easy to put the charging station in there, and it's not something that you have to reinvent the wheel. It's all pre-wired as part of the construction, and so that's something that, that we could certainly do. The other thing we could do is require a minimum number of DC fast chargers, the level 3 chargers, in standalone parking garages that exceed a certain number of spaces, and require establish a requirement that all multifamily developments that are providing off-street parking install and provide access to an electrical power supply rated at level 2 or greater for all off-street parking spaces. So again, they're EV ready, and they would allow for the installation of additional electrical vehicle parking chargers in the future. So as more EV cars come online, they'll be very easily able to install the charger, and they won't have to go through the expense or the approval from a condo association to create all the wiring that is now required to retrofit it.
Yeah.
Monica's here.
Hey, Monica. So, I just kind of, riff on this. I think new developments, we should have some provisions for, mandating, and I would definitely bump up 2% to higher, and then specify, because 110-volt chargers don't do the job, right? So what will happen is developers will just cheap out and say, okay, we have electrical outlets at every spot, but they won't address the need. So I think we have to have a minimum of level 2 or level 3 chargers as part of a new development, higher than 2%, and I think it would approach 10%. I don't think, we don't need 100%. The electric grid wouldn't even support that, my guess is. But not everybody's charging rapid charger every night, every single day. So it's probably, I would shoot for a 10% buffer for the level 2, level 3 number of parking spaces. 10% have to be dedicated for that. To Commissioner Fernandez's point, every space could at least have a simple 110-volt charger, which basically gets you right now a 1 or 2 miles per hour charge, which is incredibly slow. But if every development had a level 2 or level 3 charger, then you would alternate, much like you would use a valet or anything like that to really top you off.
And that's where I think your point about raising from 2% to a higher number, like 10%, makes sense. Because right now, I just don't understand. So we require new developments 2%. That's 2% of their required parking.
Correct.
But that 2% cannot be deeded to a unit, or can it be deeded? Can those be deeded to individual units?
That's up to either the condo association or the rental building how they divvy up the parking.
Because the thing is, if it's deeded to a unit, and then the 2% are ready, okay, you've maxed out on it. Now I have an electric vehicle. I live there, but how do I charge my vehicle? If we go this approach, whether it's 2% or 5% or 10%, whatever that percent be, it should be part of a designated charging area for the cars in that development. Because as you're mentioning, Mr. Chair, if you put a 110, okay, everyone gets that slower charging, but then once a week you can go in and you can use one of the level 3 chargers and top off your car one of the level 3 chargers if it's made to be shared.
It's got to be part of the common elements.
Part of the limited common elements.
You raise a good point, yeah. I hadn't thought of, but yeah, you're right. A developer will say, yeah, we'll comply with this, but we'll deed it to the penthouse, and no one gets to use the level 2, level 3 chargers. So I think, Tom, if you want to bring this back, we'll workshop a little bit more. But, I think bump it up. My recommendation would be 10% of spaces be dedicated to a level 2, level 3 charging unit, part of the common area. So it's not, to your point, deeded away so people can't use it. It's like building a pool, but it's for private use and not common elements. I would support saying that every spot should at a minimum have an electrical outlet to plug into.
Pre-wired to pre-wired. Be able to.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a new development, so it really is, there's an expense to it, but if it's a new development, it's not onerous. And it becomes a selling feature to that project anyway. Ultimately, the tenants will pay for that, but pre-wiring every spot is not onerous, especially 110. It's not going to overload. It won't overload. It'd be like having an extra electrical outlet in your unit for a hairdryer or whatever. Like yeah. It says,
publicly, we need to up our game publicly on this. And I know Monica has been working with FPL, and we have a procurement out there for our garages as well. But we really need to set internally within our organization a goal by which our, you know, we need at least one major parking lot in North Beach, one major parking facility in Mid Beach, and one major parking facility in South Beach to be retrofitted, where you can have in North Beach 50 public parking spaces where you have electric charging available, you know, 50 in Mid Beach, 50 in South Beach. It just can't be, oh, we have one in one parking lot or two in a parking lot, and then in another parking lot we have two. We need to have, you know, when you look at what Tesla does, mm-hmm. you know, you go to, if you're on the turnpike and you're driving, you see at the rest stops, Tesla has, you know, their bank of sometimes, I think it's like a dozen. A dozen charging stations. That's what we need throughout our city, except just foreseeing the demand of the future, we're going to need more than a dozen. We're going to need more than that because we are a very dense city and we're becoming more dense. And so many people are using these electric vehicles for road trips. And it's part of being a destination. We need to offer this. And so I think we just need to refocus again in those efforts because we brought it up a year ago. We should bring it up every year, but we really need to see greater, bigger progress on it.
Yeah, excellent points. Was just thinking, you know, Aspen Climate Change is here this week, which is
next
great
week.
To have them. Well, yeah, right, next week. I'm already rolling into next week, so we're halfway.
Are they fact-checking you, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, no, it's good. It's next week, but I'm... Anyway, I'm already in next week. I'm already sliding into the weekend.
So am I, actually.
But
I'm already in next week.
Literally, I am. But so they're here next week. I know the mayor is going to have a lot of keynote addresses and things like that, but let's give them these talking points to say that, you know, Miami Beach is leading the way on this. To your point, talking about going to other countries where they have emission-free zones, yeah. I mean, we're not going to be able to actually accomplish that in the near future here in Miami Beach, but, you know, every little bit helps. So to the extent that we can have higher penetration rates on EVs in our city, a lot less, you know, carbon monoxide that we have to breathe as residents. And if we're doing that because we're making charging stations more readily available, thereby increasing the adoption rate of EVs for our residents, you know, we're doing our part to, you know, help breathe clean air in our environment.
And less noise.
And less noise. Now, the big one would be our buses and trolleys, which, you know, pump a lot of carbon monoxide and noise. If we can get those things to be cleaner and quieter, that'd be a huge win. But the technology's not quite there. They're very expensive to go.
You just touched on a subject for me. I should have brought it up yesterday at Neighborhoods, and I didn't when I was talking about something having to do with the beach walk. There are a lot of vehicles on the beach and the beach walk, these little golf carts that, you know, sometimes sanitation uses or some of our permittees on the beach use. They're loud. They're obnoxious. They don't smell good when they go by. There's nothing worse than, you know, to be on the beach and trying to do a breathing meditation, and then you hear, bah, 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 you know, from these cars, besides the fact that it's bad for the environment. What can be, I mean, and just passing this along for whoever's listening in the administration, what can we do to transition in our own fleet those these vehicles we use on the sand and those who we permit out there, transition out of gasoline, let's put it electrics. You know, again, it's about reducing noise, making us truly an environmental conscious community, and it really makes the destination so much more pleasant when people come and experience our beach.
Good point.
bring it to the next commission meeting, put it on the agenda, is to the extent that our beach vehicles, you know, the golf carts or the four-wheel drives are gas-powered, to what extent can we convert? Because the technology is there, I know, for the golf carts for sure. I don't know how many are gas-powered or electric in our city fleet, but there's some very, very capable electric golf carts that can run on sand. I don't think we need gas.
We did it with the leaf blowers.
The leaf blowers, yeah. Okay. Tom, on this item, do you want to bring something back, some further?
Yeah, my thought was I could bring back a draft ordinance based upon the criteria that we've discussed for the committee to discuss, and perhaps we could continue this to the May meeting so we have enough time to draft that.
Okay. Okay.
You want to do that by acclamation?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. You want to squeeze one more in, colleagues?
One of Alex's?
Yeah. Pick one that we can just get off our list. You know, that's you know, a couple minutes long.
13? Do you want to discuss 13? 16 is about parking. 17 is one that I feel very passionate about.
I'm fine with 17 because I know my mind's made up on that one. So you want to tee it up, 17?
Sure. Let me just open up 17.
Yeah, I'll tee it up for you. Sure. To go discuss criminal penalties for demolition by neglect when civil penalties remain unpaid at the time of demolition.
So, you know, I brought this item. You know, I think a lot of us were very upset at how the demolition of the DeVille occurred, the negligence of the property owner that led to the many circumstances that followed, and what was more upsetting about it all is that there were, you know, unpaid civil fines, and here they are demolishing the building with monies still being owed to the city. And that's not right. When someone abandons a historic asset like that, that person should feel privileged that to be owning a piece of our history, a piece not just of our history, where culture, American culture, occurred there. Where the Beatles performed, where precedents stayed, but most importantly, assets that are iconic to our city. It's horrible when they let them get to the point of such great negligence that they have to be demolished because they're deemed unsafe, and it's disrespectful to the city when they just ignored the civil fines. But when it gets to that point, that the city has enforced, and that there's been fines levied against them, and I think it's what, in the millions, the monies owed to the city, and then they're able to demolish the property while millions are still being owed, not to us, to the public, being owed to the public. To me, that's criminal, because at the end of the day, that person has allowed the property, in my opinion, to enter this level of neglect, to be demolished only to raise their property value, only to deprive the community of this historic asset so they can get a clean canvas upon which to build a new building on. And I know we've adopted policy to address that, about what could be built on a parcel that housed a historic asset that was demolished by neglect. But we can't let that happen again. We can't get to that point, and we have to put the safeguards in place so that the message is out. You can ignore our codes, you can ignore the fines, and you can choose your property getting to a point of demolition by neglect. But when you do that and you haven't paid up to the public what is owed to the public, then that's criminal. And that's the purpose of this item, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, like I said, my mind's made up. I fully support it.
Thank you.
You know, especially, you know, with the dollars at play, you know, even a $5 million civil fine when you allow your property to, you know, get into such disrepair where the only course is to demolish it, but, you know, you have a $500 million payday, you know, the choice is obvious. It's the same reason we have criminal penalties for environmental pollution, right? Like if it was just, you know, a civil fine, $1,000, $2,000, whatever, you pay the fine and dump your waste into the water and anywhere you want. You know, sometimes criminal penalties get people's attention
to urgent public policy matters. So I'm fully supportive of this. Now, the question we have for, I think, Nick, is the legality of this, how you would implement it. I know my feeling is you can't do this retroactive. You know, no. We have ex post facto laws, right, in this country. You can't do it. But prospectively, I don't know, can we do this?
What we think, and we've looked at this internally, and we've discussed this issue a couple of times in the past with the sponsor, but there are a couple of issues that we'd need to iron out. The first one being intent, and typically criminal penalties are associated with conduct that's intentional. So what I'd like, if the committee would like, is supportive of this item, is I'd like to work with the sponsor to try to identify how we characterize, you know, what is the conduct that's going to give rise to criminal penalties. And I think at a minimum we should look at the intentional conduct that gives rise to the demolition of a contributing building. But I'd like to work on legislation with the sponsor before this comes back.
And that's reasonable, and maybe even look at the thresholds of the monies owed to the city, because I think, you know, if we're talking about $50,000, is not the same as, you know, someone owing to the city $1 million or $2 million or more. So maybe I don't know if we can also look at that as well.
We can look at the issue of whether fines can give rise. Sure.
Yeah, you want to make this pass legal muster, right? I mean, right. Criminal is the highest sort of level penalty you can have, so it's going to bear the most legal scrutiny. So I think you have to, prepare yourself to maybe be a little disappointed, but craft something that will have teeth and pass legal muster. To Nick's point about intent, I'm sure, we can create thresholds where, it's very, very clear that somebody who is not complying would lead one to the conclusion that it's an intentional noncompliance, not like, I've been traveling, I've been out of the country, I didn't get notice,
right.
I don't have the money. There's got to be the threshold. It's a high bar mm-hmm. in order for it to be enforceable, so just prepare yourself for that.
Yeah, and the point is to discourage the negligent behavior. That's ultimately it, because there's, as you well mentioned, there's people that have, change of life circumstances. They get sick. Their spouse who managed the property passes away, and they don't know how to manage. I mean, there's so many circumstances that come into play, and maybe even we look at giving the commission authority to the same way that we give the HPB certain powers to do certain things, to have certain requirements in terms of replication and all that, maybe do something similar here. So I look forward to working with Nick. Now knowing that you supported, Mr. Chair, I'll work with the city attorney's office on language. Commissioner Dominguez, I don't know where you stand on this item.
Fully supportive as well. And as long as we can legally put something forth like this, yes, absolutely.
Perfect. So I'll work with staff, and we'll bring something
forward. Nick, when would you like to come back? Would you need a couple months?
I think May.
May 10th?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll continue this to May 10th.
Perfect. All right, colleagues, we're out of time. I want to thank you all for being here. We'll see each other in a few hours here. It's not in chambers later. It's a city manager's commission and conference room. Okay, great.
And well, just for the record, the remainder of the items that we didn't get to are automatically deferred to the April 100%. Meeting.
100%. Thanks.